update on those, and then we will take questions. In certain parts they overlap, in certain parts quite clearly there's no movement on the 2019 recommendations. And there's been subsequent reports as well, and there have been oversight visits that we have done to ESCOM, Medupi, Usile, Tutuga. I was counting yesterday. I think we've met on ESCOM with ESCOM just over 30 times. It's the most regular appearance before us. I'd like to welcome the Minister and the Chairperson of the Board and the Board Members, Acting CEO and all the Executives. But more specifically, Mr. Chairman, welcome. This will be the first appearance since you assumed the office. Welcome. And I noticed every time there's a new chair we meet in this room, so we must call this the new ESCOM Chair's Room. It happens quite regularly that it's here. So what we'll do, colleagues, we're going to go straight into the presentations. We'll start with the Minister if there's any opening remarks that you may have. And then Chairperson, you will delegate your team as you deem fit, and we'll give you an opportunity to make remarks as well. Just one disclaimer, please assume correctly that the presentations are taken as read. So it's the salient points, and if there's anything specific that members will want to go to, they will return to it in the presentation. This is just helpful for the purposes of time management as well. Minister, good morning. Welcome, and over to you.
Good morning, Chairperson, and good morning to the honourable members. For me, it's just to say that, as you've said, the ESCOM colleagues will present the results of the last financial year first, and then look at matters that are outstanding as far as SCOPA is concerned. Secondly, I have the pleasure of introducing Mr. Nyati as the new chairperson of the board, and you can inform him about his parliamentary rights as he makes his maiden speech here as we go on. And thirdly, you've got all the senior managers here responsible for different aspects of ESCOM's work, and they're at your disposal should you have any questions about any aspect, not just the financials, of ESCOM's progress. For the rest, let's wait the questions, and we'll take over from there. And if you don't mind, Chair, let me invite the Chair of the Board to say a few words. Thank you.
Thank you, Minister, and good morning, Chairperson of SCOPA, Mr. Nkuleko Hlengwa. Good morning, honorable members of SCOPA. It's really, really good for me to be sitting here representing the ESCOM board. I've heard from the chair that we have been having a lot of changes. I hope this is not going to be something, we're going to be having more changes. We're looking forward to having this engagement here with you today. So on behalf of the ESCOM board, I just want to thank SCOPA for this opportunity to account to the South African public. Being on the SCOPA's agenda reaffirms the importance of ESCOM's operations to the economy of this country. Upfront, I would like to address the issue of the appointment of the ESCOM Group Chief Executive. Recently, we as the board submitted three names of appointable candidates to our minister here, Mr. Pravin Gordhan. He is now taking these names through the relevant government processes. We expect the appointment to be made before the end of this year. So, honorable members, as you know, it is my first appearance at SCOPA as the chairman of the ESCOM board. Please rest assured that there will be continuity. What we plan to change, though, is the speed of implementation of actions and programs. That is one aspect that we have identified as a team as an area of improvement. Honorable members, following our engagement in June 2023, ESCOM's operational performance has improved notably. When we met in June during SCOPA's three-day visit to ESCOM, there was a potential risk of heightened load shedding beyond stage six. However, credit to the generation team under the leadership of Mr. Beki Nxumalo, ESCOM did well to prevent the worst-case scenario. They achieved this through disciplined execution of the board and DPE-approved generation recovery plan. We are also beginning to see some positive changes as we enter spring, and we have seen in the last while that we have gone through a period of at least 1 week without load shedding. As they say, a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. We have taken our first steps and are beginning to walk with confidence. The improved generation performance has had a positive impact on the morale of the employees of ESCOM. It is giving our employees every reason to ensure that today is better than yesterday, and tomorrow will be better than today. Continuous improvement is our new mantra. So as a board, we are optimistic that the recent improvement in plant performance and the measures being taken to root out corruption will continue yielding positive results. Our priority is to stabilize the ESCOM leadership while providing them with the necessary support to deal with all of the challenges. We continue to work with law enforcement agencies to root out corruption and malfeasance and recover ill-forgotten money, bring those accused of corruption to account. A dedicated ESCOM State Capture Task Team also continues to do its work to address the findings of the Zondo Commission report. We are closely monitoring all criminal activities and are working with law enforcement agencies to ensure that perpetrators are brought to book. We are also strengthening our whistleblower support for the ESCOM employees who continue to help expose wrongdoing. We are cognizant of our role in the economic growth and the development of our country. When ESCOM provides security of supply, businesses can run and people can be employed. South Africans depend on ESCOM to keep the wheels of our economy turning, enabling them to be able to put food on the table for their families. So on this note, I would like to reiterate ESCOM's commitment to resolving the challenges that hamper our daily aspirations to achieve operational excellence and financial stability. Our mission to provide sustainable electricity solutions to grow the economy and improve the quality of life of people in South Africa and the region. It is through the conscious efforts of our employees that we are able and will be able to deliver on this mission. So, honorable members, it is not lost to the board of ESCOM that South Africa is counting on all of us in ESCOM. We know that failure is not an option. We'd like to commit here and say to you that we are not going to disappoint. We understand the responsibilities that is on us, and we'll continue to work on making sure that we bring a better tomorrow than where we are today. Thank you so much. So with those few words, Chair, I'd like to hand over to our CEO to take us through the group annual results for the year 2023. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Just to mic Chair, thank you for those remarks.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, Honourable Minister and Chairman of the Board. If we can move to the next slide. I think as indicated by the Chairperson, I think before you even look at the financial results, we know in Eskom the operational performance filters directly into your financial performance, and critical to that as the key contributing factor to the overall finances of Eskom is generation, understanding that represents about 70% of our entire business. We found that for March 2023, with the deteriorating generation performance, the energy availability factor worsened from 62% to 56%, and this did culminate in a significant increase in the number of days of load shedding, not only just the days, but the intensity as well that will be indicated in one of the next slides. 280 days is significant. Up until October, we were sitting around 202 days of load shedding for this current financial year. I think the importance, as our chairperson has indicated, through the generation leadership under Becky and the changes he's made at power stations, we did see positive trends coming through in the month of October. Yes, you are going to have a few days where it is difficult, like we've had last week, but I think what is comforting from where I'm sitting and with Becky's leadership, when we get into a difficult few days, the generation team recovers quite quickly, unlike before. And the other positive that's come through in the generation performance, you make certain tough decisions early in the week, so you don't, it doesn't result in more difficult and higher stages of load shedding later on. So I think we've taken a lot of lessons from the past that we've built into the performance. And as we've indicated in our summer outlook, we are quite convinced and comfortable that stage four load shedding, that's the peak we want to reach in the summer period. Obviously, we want it as low as possible. And more importantly, from an economic growth perspective, not to load shed during the day and it's just evening peaks. So far, October has been great. We've only touched stage three, and we're focusing on continuing with that trend going forward. We must not forget the importance from an environmental performance and the emissions. We did find deterioration in terms of particulate emissions, specifically from Kendall. That remains a key focus from an Eskom perspective, and through Becky and his leadership. Unfortunately as well, we found that in the last year, transmissions reliability did drop. On the positive side, through Monday Bala, distribution has maintained its positive performance, and that must continue. I think from a new build perspective, what we have appreciated is one, firstly, the ability to bring back the units under the temporary stack in Kusile with Unit 3 and Unit 1 back. We've seen what a big difference that reliability of baseload capacity has done to the overall supply and demand equation. We're looking forward to the last unit coming back by the end of November. And more importantly, then Unit 5 will get onto the grid by December. That gives us confidence when we move into the new financial year. I think while I'm talking on generation, we must not forget the importance of Coburg. Our understanding is later this week Unit 1 will come back from the steam generator replacement and now be synchronized to the grid. But as we've always indicated, Honorable Chair, that you won't see an incremental benefit because then Unit 2 goes out for its steam generator replacement. But I think it's a massive milestone in the journey of Coburg's intention to extend its life in terms of its long-term operations. From a socioeconomic perspective, sadly we have lost 4 employees and contractors combined during the last year, and the last time injury rate has deteriorated. On the positive side, we've seen in terms of the Youth Employment Services Program, we've employed 523 youths. And then from a financial perspective, despite having a 9.61% tariff increase year on year, we found that combination of the difficult generation performance meant that higher, more expensive plants were utilized during the year, in particular our open cycle gas turbines combined with the IPPs. We spent about 30 billion during March 2023, and we're forecasting a similar combined spend for March 2024. Martin Bates, our acting CFO, will unpack that in more detail. What we were able to achieve during that March 23 was to secure funding of just under 60 billion, and we needed to do that in light with the support, and we appreciate the government debt relief of 254 billion. There was a period until the bill was enacted that we had to make sure we can fund in literally that first quarter. Martin will then go into explaining and unpacking that funding and what it meant in terms of the cash flows. And then, yeah, the new board is in place for an entire year. If we then just touch on the generation performance, I've spoken to a lot of this just to highlight again that it's critical, and our most important focus is the generation performance and what it means to the economy. And it's not only happening in generation. What we do see in the organization and what we are trying to build as an executive team as well, we are all working together for one objective, supported by distribution, transmission, and the supports structures in terms of the corporate divisions. And I think that morale is coming through not only at an ExCo team, but more importantly, filtering through throughout the organization. As we've indicated, you will see when I present on the outlook, I think, Honorable Chair and members, you've got to look through, obviously, these results, and you'll see the indication as we presented last week that FY24 is not going to be fundamentally different to FY23 because the drivers are clearly the same factors that are influencing. But when we go beyond that, on the back of a better generation performance, and we also add the importance of the incentives through the National Treasury on how do you deal with municipal debt. It's still early days, but a number of municipalities have committed to sign up, I think some 67, which represents 97% of the outstanding debt. From August, we've been monitoring, and Mr. Bala is closer to it, the keeping up of the current account payments have been very positive, and that trend is critical to Eskom, because you will see in the last financial year, March 23, our inability to collect from municipalities meant we could not recognize 8 billion as revenue during this past financial year, and a similar amount projected for March 2024. I think importantly, looking at the networks together with the debt relief, it's allowed us to release capital expenditure for 3 years in advance, which means the spares and the necessary procurement processes can now happen way in advance, which then gives important impetus in terms of making sure the necessary investments into your assets do occur, not only in generation, but importantly in the network businesses, especially if we take into account the significant amount that's required for transmission over the next 10 years to install some 14,000 kilometers of line, and in distribution 8,000 kilometers of line. I've spoken about the importance of Kusile to stabilizing the supply side, and then the importance of ramping up the transmission rollout of kilometers of line, not only from a grid perspective, but also we know that what has happened in the recent past, because of the grid constraints, we were unable to connect the IPPs to the grid in terms of previous bid windows 5 and 6, and we need to address that to ensure future bid windows are a success. We are looking at initiatives such as curtailment in the initial years to allow for the transmission grid and some changes in queuing rules on distribution to allow access to happen much more faster, as the Chair has indicated. If we go on to the next slide, in terms of the load shedding, as we've said, we can see that significant ramp up from 22 to 23, and in the different levels of load shedding, you know, 34 occasions of stage 6, 95 occasions of stage 4. So we need to really focus on bringing that under control and then closing this gap in terms of dispatchable capacity of 4 to 6,000 by unlocking the grid going forward. If you go on to the next slide. Just a bit on the environmental side, over and above the emissions. Yes, the CO2 emissions has reduced year on year, but that's on the back of lower production from the generation side. On the water side, there's been some slight improvement in terms of the liters per kilowatt hour. But again, in a water-constrained country, we need to focus on improving that even further as Eskom's contribution to the country. I've touched on many of the items under people and society. Maybe just from a racial and gender equity, that has improved year on year. And in terms of electrification, during FY23, we have connected just under 103,000 connections for the first time over the last financial year. Our corporate social investment, 63 million compared to 75 million. We need to focus on also improving that and benefiting many more beneficiaries through our initiatives as Eskom. I will now, Honourable Chair, hand over to Martin Bayes to take us through the details of the financial opinion and the financial results, and then I'll conclude on the way forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Honourable Chairman and Honourable Members. If I can start first of all with the PFMA, just give you an overview. Just to make it clear that in terms of Instruction Note 4 that was issued by National Treasury, we now report the results of the PFMA, a portion in the annual financial statements and a portion in the integrated report. The portion in the financial statements deals just with the expenditure for the current year and the prior year. Now, in terms of the audit itself, the PFMA was qualified. Now, when you look at PFMA, there are two elements to that. The one element deals with the accuracy of the information. And although we've done a lot of hard work to make sure that the information is accurate as possible, the auditors concluded that the information is not accurate. And then the second issue deals with completeness. Now, completeness is an issue that comes with a legacy, where the auditors are saying we cannot rely on the information provided in the past itself, and that was the reason for the qualification. When we look at irregular expenditure, we see that the irregular expenditure for this financial year was 5 billion rand, and it consists of two elements, new incidents of 2.6 billion, and then historic incidents of 2.5. Now, the historic incidents refers to irregular expenditure of the past, and we're still drawing down on those contracts, and those expenditure will continue until such time as it's either condoned or the contract expires. On the new incidence of the 2.6 billion, there are two big issues. The one issue was a non-compliance to the National Industrial Program itself, participation program, of about 2 billion rand, and that was a foreign transaction, and not all the requirements were complied with. And then there was also one transaction for urgent procurement of fuel oil of 270 billion, and then it leaves you with the rest of the irregular expenditure. On the fruitless and wasteful expenditure, we incurred 105 million this year. It consists mainly of one transaction, and that relates to an overpayment in Kusile of 102 million itself. We are still investigating other areas of Kusile, so in the future we may see some additional reporting in terms of fruitless and wasteful. On the material losses through criminal conduct, what I would like to show is the estimated non-technical losses of 5.6 billion. Now, just to remind everybody, that is an estimate of the cost that Eskom incurred by providing electricity that is either with meter tampering took place or theft of energy or illegal connections. So that is the cost. Now, previously we made an assumption that when you look at the distribution, there are two elements. The one element is technical losses, which is part of the business, and then the non-technical losses. Now, in the past, we made an assumption that it's 70% technical and 30% non-technical. We've done a study, and the study proved that it's 70% non-technical and 30% technical. So that's why there's such a huge increase compared to the previous year. Next slide. On the financial side, and I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, we will see that most of the ratios has deteriorated. I think what is very important is if you look at the EBITDA line, the previous year was 52.9 billion and it reduced to 38 billion. And then also the EBITDA margin dropped from 21 to 14. And if you look at the pre-tax nominal return on assets, 0.83%, that is saying to you, if you put your money in the bank, you only earn 0.83% on your assets. We can also see that all the other ratios trended negatively. Next slide. On the income statement, as I said, the EBITDA, you reduced from 52 to 38 billion. The question can be raised, but if you received a 9.6% increase in your price, why is that that your EBITDA reduced? And the answer lies in, first of all, if you look at the revenue line, it only went up with 5% because there was a 5% reduction in the sales volumes, and then the rest is then made up with the price increase. On the primary energy, you see that's a 17% increase, and I will unpack that a little bit further. The net employee benefit expenses, we can see it is very much in line with the previous year, despite the fact that the bargaining unit got a salary increase, and the main reason why we could maintain the same level was because there was a reduction in the manpower numbers. Then if you look at the other operating expenses, it's gone up from 28 to 34 billion, and the main reason for that is an increase in the maintenance, and specifically in the generation environment. That then leaves you with the EBITDA of 38, and then the next important line is then your net finance costs. You can see there's an increase from 33% to 37%. And 37 billion, and I will also unpack that. Then it leaves you with an increase in the net loss from 11.9 to 23.9, so it's almost doubling up. Next slide. This is just a quick unpack of it, the net loss, and you can see 12% better, 12 billion better in revenue, primary energy taking up 15, then fuel oil taking up 3, repairs and maintenance 3, finance costs 4, and that leaves you then with a 24 billion rand loss after tax. Next slide. This is just the sales, and if I start at the bottom block, we can see there the reduction in the sales volumes of 5%, coming 4% from local and then 14% from the international customers itself. So that shows you the 5% reduction. If you look at the top block on the left-hand side, we can see the revenue, and that is the total billed revenue, has gone up from 240 to 255 billion. A slight reduction in the international gives you the gross electricity revenue going from 252 to 266 billion. Then there's a deduction of 8.2 billion. And the reason for that is, as the CEO explained, it's the revenue that we cannot recognize by defaulting municipalities. Now, that is in terms of international financial reporting standards. And what the standard says, if you've got a customer that is not paying you, the only way that you can recognize the revenue is on the cash basis. In other words, once the customer pays you, you will then recognize the revenue. Then we also had some other revenue as well. Gives you the total revenue of 259 billion. Next slide, please. On the primary energy, we can see the coal and other, which is including all the other plants, the peaking plants, the hydros, and we can see the cost has increased from 81 billion to 84 billion, although the volumes has dropped from 191 terawatt hours to 178 terawatt hours. You can see an increase in the cost per unit of 11% in terms of coal, and that comes very much back to the price of coal itself. Nuclear, we can see there's an increase of 6%. And then on the Eskom OCGTs, we have increased from 10 billion the previous year to 21 billion rand in FY23. So it was more than double increase. And you can see also on the gigawatt hours, but the gigawatt hours was not a double increase. And the main reason for that is if you look at the unit cost, there was a huge increase in the unit cost, and a lot of that had to do with the diesel price, plus also the exchange rate itself. Similarly, on the OCGTs, it increased from 4.6 billion to 8.2 billion, and also you can see an increase in the price itself. Interesting, the renewable IPPs, although the cost increased from 30 to 33 billion, we can see that the production went from 15 terawatt hours to 16.8 terawatt hours, and there was a small reduction in the cost of 2%. And what we find is, as new entrants into the market, that the costs are busy coming down. Then on the import, basically on Cora Bassa, it's an agreement that we have, and that shows the escalation. There is a clause that every 5 years we readjust the price for Cora Bassa. So that shows you the total increase in the cost for the primary energy from 132.9 billion to 154 billion, which is a 23% increase. Next slide. If I look at the cash flow, we can see there from a revenue line, we collected 260 billion. Then on the operating costs, we spent 218 billion, consisting of primary energy, what we call controllable, and primary energy not controllable is really the non-controllable element. It relates very much mainly to the IPPs. And then the employee cost, there was a small increase in working capital, and then repairs and maintenance and other. It gives you an operating surplus of 42 billion. And then we paid interest out of that for 33 billion. That left the balance before investing of 8 billion. We spent cash-wise, 29 billion on our capital expenditure. And then we had to raise debt of 30 billion. Now, Caleb showed you previously that we raised about 59, or we secured 59 billion in debt. And here in the cash flow, you see 30 billion. Now, there are two reasons for the difference between the 59 that you secured and the 30 billion. Secured doesn't mean it's money in the bank. The 30 is money in the bank. With the debt relief package, we had an agreement with National Treasury that we can borrow some money towards the end of March 23. And the reason for that is that the debt relief package was only expected to be enacted in July. And usually Eskom uses money in the first 3 months of the year because of debt repayments in that period, and also that we relied on the OCGTs in that period as well. So with agreement of National Treasury, we raised approximately 15 billion, but that money did not come in before 31st of March. We received the money about the 3rd of April. So we could not reflect that money in FY23. And then also that we entered into some DFIs. Now, the way that the DFI works is that you first spend the money, and then you recover the money from the lender, and that again is in agreement with the arrangement with National Treasury. Now, DFIs are very specific funding itself. We repaid debt, 39 billion, so that then actually left you with a gap of 30 billion, and then we received the government support of 22 billion, so we had to withdraw from our cash resources with 8 billion rand. Next slide. And this is just your balance sheet itself. I don't think there's anything that I would like to show specifically except the equity line. We can see it's very much in line with the previous year. And although you received a 22 billion equity support, it was actually absorbed by the loss of 24 billion that was made. Debt securities and borrowings, and I will unpack that. It went up from 396 to 423. And then you also see a line there called other liabilities. Now, included in the other liabilities is basically two big elements. We have to provide for employee costs, specifically the post-retirement medical aid is included in there, and then all your rehabilitation provisions for the coal power stations plus nuclear is included in that 107 billion there. Next slide, please. Now, when we look at the net finance cost, increasing from 33 to 37 billion, we can see that the gross cost went from 43.6 to 47.8 billion. And then also on the borrowings cost capitalized, it dropped from 8 billion to 7.4 billion. The reason for that is as you start finishing your Medupi and Kusele specifically and you put the units in operations, you cannot capitalize finance costs anymore. So that number will come down considerably once Kusele is finished. If we look at the net debt at 31st of March, we can see the gross debt increase from 396 to 423 billion. And a big reason for that relates to the exchange rate itself. That's why you saw such a huge increase in the gross debt. The lease liability reduced a little bit. Now, let me explain the lease liability itself. In terms of IFRS, you have to look into certain transactions, and we've got two specific transactions with the IPP OCGTs, and when you look into that and you analyze it in terms of IFRS, you actually then contain a lease because you control when those stations will operate and how long they will operate. So that then says you've got a lease, but on the other side, you also got a lease asset. Then we can see there that debt derivatives helps for risk management. That is where we take out all our hedges. It was a net liability last year of 903 million. It is now a net asset of 25 billion, and that is mainly as a result of the increase or the reduction in the weakening of the reserve of the rand exchange rate. Next slide. The government debt relief package itself, we can see there that government announced 254 billion over the next 3 years, which is FY24, 25 and 26. Of the 254 billion, 184 billion will be cash, and then government will take over 70 billion worth of loans on 31st of March 2026. Now the 70 billion will consist of the capital portion plus the future interest of those loans. Now the way that it's going to work is that Eskom is going to provide upfront to National Treasury its requirement on a periodic basis. National Treasury will then provide the funding to Eskom. On a quarterly basis, we will provide a report to National Treasury confirming that we've complied with the conditions. And once National Treasury is comfortable that we've complied with the conditions, they will then give an instruction that we can convert the loan into equity. In the medium-term budget policy statement, it was announced that this loan will now carry interest as well, and the interest is only from the period we receive the money until you convert it into equity. Next slide, please. This shows you the arrear municipal debt, how it's actually increased from 44.8 billion to 58.5 billion for FY23, an increase of 31 billion. We can also see then the reduction on the Soweto debt itself, and the main reason for that is some old debt that we've written off and also some of the induplum interest itself. Now, National Treasury has implemented the Municipal Debt Relief Program, and as the Acting Group Chief Executive has said, we've already seen some improvement, but it will take time for us to understand exactly how it's going to work, what the benefit to Eskom is going to be. But the way that it's going to work, if a municipality complies with all the conditions over the 12-month period, Eskom will write off one-third of the outstanding debt. One of the big conditions in terms of the relief is that the municipalities must keep their current account current. In other words, they cannot go further into arrears. The benefit to Eskom is that we will receive the liquidity then from the municipalities. If I take you back to the previous slide where I showed 8.6 billion, and if you just assume half of that, it means Eskom will get in the order of 4 billion, 4.5 billion rand extra cash every year from those municipalities. That's the benefit to Eskom itself. Next slide. This just unpacks the three divisions of Eskom. And I think the major issue is when you look at generation, it actually reflects a result of a loss of 34 billion. In the transmission side, a loss of 1 billion, and then distribution actually making a profit of 3.5 billion. Now the question can be raised, why does distribution make a profit if they carry the overdue municipal debt, the 8.6 billion? The main reason for that is when you look into to generation, they sell the electricity onto distribution. But in terms of the tariff, they get payment for capacity and they get payment for energy. If the capacity is not available, there is a penalty that gets charged on generation, and distribution is the beneficiary of that. That is our internal transfer pricing mechanism. And I'd like to hand over to the GCE. Thank you.
Thanks, Martin. Chair, in terms of legal separation, we are at an advanced stage with regard to transmission. Our intention is to operationalize that by the end of this financial year. There are few remaining items that need to be concluded, the lender consent being an important one. Yes, NERSA has awarded the licenses, but we're still waiting to receive the detail on those licenses, and then for NTCSA to be designated the buyer of the power from the IPPs, and then the shareholder is busy with finalizing the appointment of the independent directors to NTCSA. We started the process on distribution as well. The new distribution company has been established, and then we're in the early stages on the generation side. If we move on to the next slide, in terms of Eskom's turnaround, fundamentally those turnaround objectives remain the same. Focusing on the operation recovery, linked to that closely is the financial, but you've got to deal with the culture, the people, and the ethics within the organization, roll out our separation process, while also being cognizant of the need that when the generation power stations come to the end of their lives, we would need to repower and repurpose them, and also doing it in a just manner to deal with the communities that surround those power stations. So effectively, we are balancing this energy trilemma between security of supply and the importance to the economy, while from an equity perspective, dealing with both affordability and access to electricity, but not forgetting the importance of sustainability of this electricity industry into the future. If I then move on in terms of an outlook, as indicated, the fundamental drivers still remain the same in FY24, is despite, as I've indicated, the 18.65 tariff decision for this year. The revenue will go up. There is a drop in volumes linked to the performance around the EAF. That does then give you a benefit in terms of an EBITDA growth. However, we can see with the higher operating costs, the margin is then squeezed, and operating profit up from 5.6 billion to 7.4. As you take into account the financing costs, you're then looking at an outlook forecast for March 24 of a loss of around 23.2 billion, and you see that pressure then filtering through on some key financial ratios. I think ultimately what we do see is that by the end of this financial year, that the EAF performance will improve above 2023, but we think we're going to land up on average less than 60%. The key objective, by the time you get to March 2024, you want to be touching 60% in that month. I think we achieved very close to that in the month of October. That is why that gives us some momentum moving to the rest of this financial year. And that combination of dealing with the diesel spend, addressing the benefit through the incentives of the non-payment, also as Eskom, we need to focus on our cost base, make sure it's efficient, deal with the leakages in the system, and then we believe that that combination will allow us to improve these financials significantly when you get to March 2025. So just to summarize, Chair, as the key focus areas, generation top priority in terms of those key stations, get to 65% by March, but not forgetting the importance and the investments of the networks and being able to connect capacity to the grids while dealing with all the staff issues, the culture issues, improving that ethical culture in the organization. Chairman has spoken about leadership stability as a key focus, headed up and prioritized from the Audit and Risk Committee. We know, as indicated in the audit opinion, we need to improve our controller environment significantly to address crime, fraud, corruption and criminality in the organization, and then continue on this journey of the legal separation. Ultimately, we acknowledge that how important Eskom is contributing towards the economy, and not only in terms of the financial side, but reducing the stages of load shedding, getting up in the morning with not having load shedding. That also, you start your day on a positive basis, not only within Eskom, but the entire country. And also we know at this point, with exams written at the matriculants and all the universities, we are striving not to interrupt, not to have interrupted supply during the course of the day, and minimal interruptions in the evening peak. Chair, that's the financial presentation of Eskom.
Right, thank you very much for that. I think let's go to the 2019 committee, the update on the committee recommendations and any other subsequent matters so that we can be able to interface the two presentations, because some of the issues may be an overlap. The same principle will apply to CE, take the presentation as read and cover the salient points with a particular focus on what has not been achieved and why.
Thank you, Chair, if we go through it. So in terms of the 2019, Chair, I'm not going to... The first few slides shows what the ones that were achieved, so I'll focus on the points and the recommendations that are still work in progress and not completely achieved. So with regard to the 2019, 6.4, in terms of employment of skilled staff in procurement and supply chain management, that has been rolled out in the businesses, and substantially we believe that has been achieved. Tremendous progress on that. Yes, we must still embed the discipline of that throughout the generation environment, but we've also addressed these issues in the distribution and the transmission side. With regard to vetting, we've been working with SSA. We've got a MOU agreement with them where you can clearly see, Chair, a lot of work happening not only with our board members but senior executives in terms of what vetting has been completed, what is in progress, and what is still needs to be completed from a vetting perspective under 6.5. In terms of 6.7 and internal investigations, yes, we believe in this area work has been done but still remains a key area in terms of, if we look since FY 2019-20, 746 cases were registered with 715 investigations completed. As at September 23, there's 371 active forensic investigations currently. And then you have stats over the different financial years in terms of what was the opening balances, new cases that were added, and what was concluded in the financial year. We've also, from a forensic perspective, supported capacitating that area as well, Chair, as it is a key element of our dealing with all this criminality and corruption in Eskom. We move on to the next slide. Consequence management, you can see that as at the end of September 2023, through our people relations, we've registered 398 employees who have undergone disciplinary processes. With regard to that, we see that 168 employees' contracts were terminated during this period, and then we talk about the remaining employees. 48 were dismissed due to fraud and corruption. Internal audit. Yes, similarly, 14 specialist resources were recruited in this area, and we're busy with, we've already conducted the interview process for the head or as the chief audit executive. We're busy finalizing that, and an appointment on that should be made in the next few days or 2 to 3 weeks, Chair. 6.11, employees that worked previously at Eskom and were implicated in terms of malfeasance and criminal charges against them, we can see that 195 criminal cases have been opened together with SAPS. 42 of this 195 proceedings has occurred, and we're working very closely with the law enforcement agencies, including the Hawks, SIU, SAPS, etc. Here they are situated in terms of the priority committee at ESCOM. We have weekly engagements with them through our security department, and also at an executive level I do have engagements with the heads of the respective areas with regard to dealing with this issue. Chair, we've seen also in the recent months a number of arrests that have been made, and even yesterday we just see a positive sign in terms of that asset forfeiture of a previous contractor and employees with regard to prepaid vending and I think assets to the extent of 29 million to the asset forfeiture unit. So those are positive trends that we do see, but a lot still needs to be done and working in conjunction with the law enforcement agencies. 6.13, contracts and contract management in terms of our procurement processes. We've done a number of changes in terms of our system SAP and in terms of the new regulations. Any expansions and deviations that occur are reported to National Treasury through the CPO's office. And then we have a tracking mechanism in terms of the aging of those contracts at the respective divisions, and we're working to ensure that the necessary interventions occur before contracts expire, etc. But it's just about, again, monitoring and making sure the necessary interventions do occur throughout the business. Defects with regard to Medupi and Kusile, I think we've seen in the performance of both Medupi and Kusile. Medupi is probably one of the best performing plants in terms of their availability after these defects have been implemented. There are still a few remaining items that need to occur, but we've seen that similar trend continue into the Kusile units. As we know, they literally mirror images of each other, so that is a positive sign from ourselves. And then obviously under the leadership of Becky and his teams at Medupi and Kusile, we're confident that those defects will address what needs to be required, and then we'll get the necessary performance in terms of baseload capacity from these two new stations. Coal quality, yeah, this is an important area for us. It is a difficult area. We have put in initiatives in terms of coal quality audits, and we are looking to also improve that with new technologies. We've got a big project that we're working on in terms of the coal value chain from the pit right until the power station, but that project is still under development to be implemented in 2024. But we've done some pilot projects around tracking of trucks and also testing of the quality of coal. With regard to way bridges, this remains a concern for us, Chair, in terms of our power stations. Again, we've started looking at some pilot projects with in terms of the coal offloading facilities, especially at stations like Kusile, and then we want to roll that out going forward. This remains a key focus area from our perspective, Chair. Way bridges, I've touched on this, but there's a lot more detail in terms of the contracts that we've signed with Serenity to date and the contracts that are in progress to ensure a much more longer contract for supply to the Kusile Power Station, and then also working in conjunction with other contracts throughout our coal portfolio in conjunction with Becky and Dan Mashiko, the head of Primary Energy. Take or pay, I think on this one, it's a difficult one. There has been negotiations We're also looking at mechanisms. We've just gone out on an RFP to see how we can try to monetize the huge stockpile at Medupi. We're waiting for responses on that. That is a difficult one. But we are still looking at options around Medupi's contract and also how to monetize that huge stockpile. On the gypsum side, we've issued again proposals for gypsum at Kusile Power Station on the 3rd of August. And then once we've got responses, we will then assess that. We're looking to then hopefully conclude some, do factory visits by the end of December and then move forward on that with regard to the gypsum. This one in terms of Medupi and Kusile, in terms of any further delays, I think, Chair, the progress is very positive. We are confident that we've now got our hands around this, and we see this coming through in terms of the performance. We've also touched on this in the annual results presentation. And then we have various claims against previous suppliers in terms of wrongdoing, Chair. I'm not going to go through each of them. We will take it as read at various stages, indicating the suppliers, the amount of claims that we have disputed with the suppliers, what we've recovered, and the different processes and stages we are with these legal challenges against the various suppliers. If we go on to the next. And then, Chair, if we go in terms of the 2022 recommendations, maintenance of units, I think on the back of the debt relief, as indicated, we were able to support and improve the amount of money that's allocated for the outages in generation in particular, and we're seeing the benefits come through. That's the detail of the outages, what has occurred, and some of them have been cancelled in terms of outages, but we're working on a regular basis with generation as and when it's required. We obviously have to assess the financial situation, appreciating that Eskom cannot borrow from the markets over this next 3 years, and we have no intention to go back to National Treasury and government to ask for any more money. So we are balancing the needs of what's available to us in terms of the debt relief and the cash from operations together with the maintenance that is required, particular generation, but not forgetting the network businesses. In terms of employees and cleanup, Chair, we are dealing with those areas and consequence management. We know in terms of also the times to conclude investigations has to be improved from our side, and we're working in conjunction with business and supported by HR to deal with those issues. I spoke about this in terms of supply chain management and the necessary skills and the leadership. More importantly, there are a number of training initiatives that are occurring throughout the business, and we've also aligned our policies and procedures with the latest regulations with regard to that. Procurement and planning, I think here we do produce an annual plan that's given to National Treasury. Now the focus from our side is to ensure that the execution of that plan, as our chairman has indicated, needs to be improved from our previous historical trends, that we literally implement the plan as it was designed. There's lots of room for improvement from that perspective, and then to provide those quarterly reports to the Audit and Risk Committee and our other governance structures as well, Chair, and also giving feedback of our audit recovery plan to DPE and to SCOPA. Document in terms of a fraud prevention plan, we do have that, and we've also approved our FY24 fraud prevention plan. Since the beginning of FY24, just under 4,300 assessments were done in terms of incidents, and where those assessments trigger flags, we then hand that over to forensics for investigations, and then 50 of those have been handed over to forensics for investigations. Consequence management, Chair, in terms of PFMA, etc., and compliance, we do have a loss control function that looks at this. We know that this area also needs to be supported within enhanced resources, but it doesn't only sit at the head office level. It's important that this discipline occurs throughout the organization. And again, through the Audit and Risk Committee and their guidance, this is a key area that we'll be focusing on currently and then going forward. We need to now improve on our audit opinion with regard to the PFMA in terms of irregular expenditure, fruitless and wasteful, and losses due to criminal conduct. Unit 4, in terms of Madupi, we expect that to come back after the explosion next year sometime. I think it's around August, and then that will add some 700 megawatts to the grid. So working in conjunction with regard to that, bringing back that unit and dealing with the spares from Madupi Unit 4. In terms of working with our original equipment manufacturers and transferring our skills through Vicky and the team, we are working with the OEMs and transferring of those skills. Employees are paired with General Electric operators to ensure the necessary transfer of skills occurs. And more importantly, we need to take the lessons learned from operating the FGD at Kusile to ensure that that is not repeated going forward. And as we also know, we need to roll out FGD at Madupi, so acquiring that level of skills for those two plants is a critical success factor for generation into the future. Thank you, Chair. And maybe, Chair, just the last one, I think it was the Chuka oversight visit. I'll just touch briefly and I'll ask Peggy to elaborate a bit more. He's closer to it. I think what the positive that we've seen, Chair, I think when you visited and committee Tutuka, at best we were achieving one unit from Tutuka. I think on average we've seen with the change in leadership, we've got three units, sometimes four units from Tutuka. I think a number of times they were operating and generating 1,500 megawatts of power to the grid. And we're confident that under that leadership and that team, that has been a tremendous success and has contributed to the overall betterment and performance from a generation perspective. But if you allow me, Chair, I'll ask Peggy to spend about 2 minutes to give more detail just around Tutuka and that improvement. Thank you, Honourable Chair.
No, that's fine, sir. You're confusing us because we also have a Peggy this side, which is not here today. Right, but come on over to you. Thank you, Chair. Good morning to the members, Prime Minister, and the board. Chair, I think Tutuka, the good thing is that now that power plant is stable, we don't see the units coming in and off every time. Even if they run three units, it's sort of now more stable onto the grid. We are finalizing those ones that are down. We should be starting getting them between December and January. So we should, on average, start operating on five units, except those who will be on the outages. So we have strengthened that team, and the results are showing now in terms of stability and also the morale of the employees on the ground, which is something that was lacking in the past, Chair. Thanks, Caleb.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairperson.
Chair, okay, that's the conclusion of our presentation, so we are good.
All right, thank you. Minister? Alright, colleagues, I'm going to start with Honorable Van Meer, and I'm going to start with you if you've got any questions. You're leaving early. Are you fine?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, we'll start with you because you've got an early departure.
Great. Thanks very much, and thank you for those presentations. The chair is right. I mean, over the last 4 years, we have met with ESCOM and done oversight visits with ESCOM many, many times. And I think that it is probably the single largest item that we've really dealt with. But I mean, sitting here now, I'm really asking myself, what has really changed since our first engagement? And I'm really not convinced that I'm seeing anything really new. I've got a number of questions. Chair, do you want me to run through them in one go, or do you? How would you like me to deal with it?
Put the full set.
Okay. Thanks very much.
And then they'll respond to it, and then we'll come back for a second round.
Thanks. The issue of the municipal debt, I mean, this has now been bedeviling ESCOM for years. It really is a huge issue. It has enormous ramifications. I mean, as Scopa, we've also dealt with met with a number of municipalities. We understand the depths of their problems. So I want to know why we have this optimism that it's going to be possible to get municipalities to stay current. What has changed with the municipalities that have previously been unable and unwilling to pay ESCOM but is going to change now? So I think that is really a concern. It certainly is something that also speaks to the long-term sustainability of this. What sort of plans are there to deal with potentially municipalities that going forward are going to be expecting services, but you're not going to be getting any revenue out of them? I think that's something we really need to spend a bit of time on. I'm interested in terms of looking at the entire report on the effect of inverters and people going off-grid. In terms of generation, do you have any idea of what the size is of the people who are now off-grid? And then also, I mean, one hears stories about inverters not assisting with the problem because they then obviously reload once the electricity comes on. If we could just touch on that. And then, in general, I mean, this is an entity that really comes across as really being in trouble. Costs are up, energy production is down, coal plants break down because they're old, they haven't been replaced. Maintenance has been patchy over time. There's the issues with Kuberg, with the long-term outages. Diesel costs continue to rise. The rand is in decline. That's probably very unlikely to change given what's happening at the moment across the world. Essentially, quo vadis ESCOM, where is this going? One can't continue to have a situation where this just rolls on and on and on. It's contributing to economic breakdown in the country. That obviously contributes to the cost of living crisis, and it just becomes a very vicious circle. And I'm not seeing, it's a very bad pun, I don't really mean to come out this way, but I'm really not seeing any light at the end of the tunnel. It really is problematic. And I really would like that to be unpacked some more. Then in terms of individual power stations that obviously we have visited some several times. So Tatuka, we're now hearing, has three, sometimes four turbines going and is producing better. What has happened to the very serious allegations that we've heard centering around Tatuka in terms of security and theft? That ties into the issues we've also been hearing about in Mpumalanga with coal and with cartels. Kusile, the way bridges and the development of new Lago, I'm afraid we've been hearing about this for 4 years. It's always been imminent. Is there any genuine change there? What is happening with the coal deliveries? What is happening with the huge problem that we've heard about in the past about coal theft, substitutions, et cetera, with that? And the Medupi turbine, have we got any time periods? We talk about Medupi and Kusile getting finished, but you know, quite frankly, when things like turbines get blown up and have to be replaced, that also becomes a huge problem. So also a timeline on that. I think let's start with that, and then possibly if there's time later, Chair, we can come back. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Can we get responses to that set of questions?
Chair, thanks. I'll ask Mondi Bala to deal with the Munich questions and inverters, and then Becky can deal with the generation questions around Tutuka, Fasile and Madupi as well, and then I'll come in at the end.
Thanks, thanks, Caleb. Thanks, Honorable, for the question through you, Chair. On the Munich debt, what creates this optimism? We have been working with National Treasury on this package, which we are fairly confident that if given an opportunity, that that it will work. So, as we speak, we have 67 municipalities that have applied, which for the debt relief, of which 28 that have been approved, 39 outstanding. So this 67 constitute about 95% of this 60 billion debt. So we are of the view that if the municipalities stick to their commitment, because we also believe that much as there are carrots, that there are also sticks for the municipalities that will make some inroads. I think over and above that, we need to ensure that there is a structural sort of a change in how municipalities run their electricity businesses specifically. So that we're working through the NECOM process to make sure that there is some sort of a foundational alignment to make sure that municipalities they are able to service their debt. So in terms of, I think really the optimism from our side is that for the first time in a long time we are working as organs of government and working together to find a solution. So this ourselves, National Treasury, SALGA, with the municipalities themselves. So we are looking at finding a solution. Yes, there are those municipalities that remain challenged to pay. There are those that we knew that they could always pay, but they were not paying, so this will help us to deal with those. The ones that are unable to pay, we have put packages in place to make sure that we support them and assist them to give them a chance of at servicing their at least their current accounts. On the inverters, we do not have the exact numbers. There's numbers that have been spoken about in the media, a number of 4,000 megawatts of solar panels that have been installed that we're still looking at in terms of our own system. We have seen the impact of the reduced demand, again, at specific times of day, but mainly in the day. But yeah, we see that shooting up at night, which gives us a view as to what is really the installed base as far as the solar rooftop solar is concerned. The effect of inverters, what we had picked up is that we had something that we loosely term a shift in the peak, in that when load shedding starts, people then discharge their inverters because now they use their systems to keep the lights on, and when the load shedding ends, you then have the inverter switching back on, which would then constitute a new peak now. So we are working through our comms to educate the public in how we can lessen the impact on the grid for the inverters to be charged up. The inverters not assisting on the grid, I think the challenge is always will always be that when the sun is not shining, it will always be will always allow the grid to be available. So at night, we know that the inverters, with the battery specifically, they've got a specific discharge cycle. So when the energy in the batteries go out, normally the batteries would not last you through the night. So at some point in the night, you then require the grid to be there, so that we you can continue having electricity. So in as far as the inverters, at certain points in time in the day, yes, they do assist, and we've seen the impact thereof. But at some at specific times, specifically at night, or on days where there is sustained cloud cover, then you require the grid to be there. Thank you. Thank you, Caleb.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Chair, if I may talk to the last two questions. Let me start with the Medupi one. Medupi, Chair, I think through the support from the board, we have been able now to place a contract with our OEM to get the second-hand generator. So that generator, our team was there in Netherlands September, then we have tested it with the OEM, happy with the result, so that generator will be shipped towards the end of the year. It will be shipped to the country. It should arrive here end January, early February next year. Then we will then transport it to Medupi. So we're still putting all the plans to finalize that by end of July, August next year to get that unit back. So if the through transportation there are no delays, so the teams is really working hard to make sure that this unit gets back online as soon as August next year it should start producing again. Then with regard to Tuga in terms of the coal theft, I think I must also thank the government and the police as well and the military that is also around the station that is helping as well, so that management can then also focus on running the power station rather than really be busy with those other issues that are outside running the station. So the police has been quite helpful there. We haven't had copper theft issues as well, and also our security inside, we have also beefed it up. And we are also working to roll out cameras across all the stations as well, just to create this further deterrence in that aspect. So then it gives management opportunity to focus on running the station. Then when it comes to Usile, I think, Honorable Chair, we did indicate in our feedback that the mine now, we have also signed the contract. They are busy with the main conveyor now from the mine. There is already two pits that we are already mining from at Kusile. So we have also given now the mine is busy developing the conveyor belt now that's going to come from the mine to the station. Should be finished by 2025. I think Dennis here can add. 2025, we should have now that conveyor running. It will also assist with the congestions of the truck within the station, because some of the coals will be offloaded from that mine site. And then for Usile in particular, we have planned now so that we are able to run the five units that will be running from December. That's why all the way bridges that are there at Usile, they are all operational and functional. So we should be fine. We are still delivering with the trucks, but we have now done some lot of work to ensure that there is no bottleneck to run the five units come the end of this year at Kusile. And then the issues of coal thefts, it's an ongoing issue. What we have also changed internally as ESCOM now, we have taken responsibilities back to the mines, that the mine become responsible from the mine gate up to the ESCOM gate for security of the coal. So whatever happened in between stays with the mine. So although our teams, together with the police as well, there is some sporadic checks, but that is one of the things that we have done to put the control back to the mine. You see, we will pay you when you deliver the coal at the station gate, and then from there we will then take it over. So yeah, there is some issues that we normally with the police work that they are doing as well, that they will still find some of the people and then we deal with them. And we have quite decisive as well in terms of what we are doing to make sure that people, when they get found with the issues of timbering and all of those things. And then Caleb did touch on what we are also rolling, that eventually we want all the trucks to be on the monitoring system as well, both the horses and trailers, so that we can also monitor it remotely as well, although the responsibility is with the mine, but because of the history that we have seen on that, we felt it's still important that we invest in those technologies as well. Thank you, Chair.
Minister?
So firstly, the question from Honourable Feminine is what has changed. I think a lot has changed. You have a new board, you've got a fair amount of cleaning up following on the findings of the Zondo Commission. There are some lapses on the forensic side, but the board is beginning to attend to those. But rooting out the culture of corruption, both within Eskom and amongst businesses that do work with Eskom, is still a challenge. And there seems to be no limit to the greed that permeates that whole ecosystem. So secondly, the President had the Energy Action Plan. The Crisis Committee has got, as you know, 8 or 9 work streams, each of which are committed to perform their functions. Amongst them, Ms. Nwalo referred to the law enforcement side. But the bottom line is Eskom requires more megawatts or more electrons to come into the system. And some of that has happened in the last year as a result of the fact that there's no ceiling in terms of the IPPs on the renewable side being approved. There's work, of course, on the transmission side that needs to be done, but we now have a plan. We're about to get the company going, and that will take off in the course of the next couple of weeks. And then we'll work out how to finance the new transmission lines that need to be actually installed. We have a new IRP due from the DMRE, and let's call it IRP 23, and that will give some indication of the energy mix and how soon what can be done to bring these new megawatts online. But some of that could have happened faster than it is happening at the moment. But let's wait for that IRP to actually emerge. We have a number of external factors here we don't often discuss, even in the presentations before you, globally. So the geopolitics and the geoeconomics that impact on developing countries or emerging markets is quite a devastating one, because interest rates have gone up in terms of borrowing, bonds and bond prices and yields fluctuate quite strongly. Exchange rates are dependent upon the reserve currency of the globe, i.e. the dollar. So there are a number of factors over which South Africans have no control, and we've got to admit that and navigate that terrain. Nonetheless, you will recall that we have said to, or Eskom has said to PetroSA that it should not be making a margin on sale of diesel to Eskom. That margin is still there, and that needs to be something that is rectified, because in essence, Eskom is subsidizing PetroSA's operations at the moment, although there's a whole lot of changes that are taking place in their Central Energy Fund over time. I think it might be useful for you to invite the law enforcement arm of NECOM to explain what progress they're making. There are some indications, again, from the generation side of the business that the initiatives that we've been reading about in the last couple of weeks is making some kind of impact, as is the set of changes that have been indicated this morning to yourselves as well. But the key is still the culture of corruption in the ecosystem that we need to combat, and It seems, as I say, that greed is a powerful motive force in terms of undermining institutions like ESKOM under all sorts of pretexts that one might actually find at this point in time. So there's progress, I think, on a number of different fronts, and that progress, at least at the stabilization of load sharing, as the acting CEO pointed out, is something that we should actually acknowledge. But ultimately, as I said, it's the new megawatts that come into the system that's going to make a difference. But as Mr. Bala pointed out, weather is a key determinant of whether renewables supply the required amount of energy that one expects from them. So that's another area that the committee might want to look at. Lastly, I think the municipal debt formula that ESKOM and the Treasury have arrived at is a breakthrough, that it will make a difference. It will provide, if you like, incentives. So there's a carrot and stick approach in this regard. But it's a creative formula to break through some of the barriers that we've experienced over the last few years as the debt actually accumulates. And it needs to be given time to prove itself something that can actually work in this process. But corruption is going to carry on unless law enforcement and the prosecuting authority put the real ringleaders behind bars. Whether one likes it or not, there are not enough people in orange uniforms at this particular point in time. So that kind of culture and the way of doing business continues because the risk is not as material as it should be. But we'll return to that theme later on as well. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to also add a little bit on what has changed operationally. I'll start with the new board, which was appointed October last year. There is a committee of the board that was set up. It's called Business Operations Performance Committee. This is where a significant number of engineers who are sitting on the board are sitting on that committee. And their first responsibility when they joined the board was first to understand what the challenges are operationally, and then together with management come up with a plan that is going to help us to get out of this problem that we're facing. And we came up, and that plan was presented to the board in March of this year. It was approved by the board, was presented also to the DPE. It was approved by DPE. It's a 24-month plan. And that, when I was referring in my opening remarks to the disciplined execution of a plan, we call it a generation recovery plan, that is the thing that is making a difference right now. We have limited resources as a country, as ESKOM. We could not focus on everything. So we decided that there are power stations that are doing well. Let's protect those. Let's make sure that they continue to do well, the four of them. Then there were six other power stations that were contributing the most to the problems that we're facing in ESKOM. We decided to focus our efforts on those top six. And Tutuka is one of those. And Matla is one of those. And Kusile is one of those. The performance that we're starting to see now, overall, where we're sitting in the last month, our EAF touched 60%. As part of this plan, the end of March next year, we plan to be in at 65% EAF. And we can see us getting there, you know. So it's really going, the key is to do what we said we're going to do and thus continue to do that in a disciplined way. The thing that has helped us to get to that point is leadership. The appointment of Becky, which we did immediately, the plan was approved. He was then appointed as the as the group executive for generation. In turn, he moved quickly because he understands that environment. He moved quickly to identify which power stations were being led by people who may not necessarily be at the right level to lead those power stations. He then made the necessary changes. And the change that we're seeing, for example, in Tutuka, is as a direct result of the leadership change. It was that the changes need to be happening at a local level. That's where things matter. And that is the thing that is making a difference. It's the people, it's the leadership, it's people holding others accountable. It's people making sure that, if things are not being done, there are consequences to that. And that starts with leadership. And that is what is making a big difference. And having also a board that is engaged and people that are, from time to time, on almost every month, we've got management coming to that committee and communicating where are we against the plan, what support do we need from the board to make sure that we become successful. And that is the thing that is making a difference. So I just wanted to add those points, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Prabhu Swamya.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. Morning to the Minister, the Chair of the Board and the Board, and the Executive of ESCOM. In the first instance, Chair, I think we really need to acknowledge the fact that our oversight to ESCOM has yielded some positive results, looking into a number of areas that were referred to them as early as 2019-20, looking into the grey, the green identified areas in terms of achievement, which themselves have a impact in the turnaround of functionality of ESCOM. I think we need to appreciate that fact. Secondly, if we take, I prefer to take it as an example of Tutuka lessons. In Tutuka, when we went there, after we've gone into a number of other the generation stations, we have found out a number of operational challenges which have somewhat been tasked in a way through generation temp change. And there are others who are of a governance related decisions which had to be tampered with. There were about five or six matters which had to be reversed by the board, which have been a decision of the board, who have tampered with functionality of Tutuka. So I'm going to track that as part of exemplary 10 of issues in a specific area. And if you look and track the improvement which has been there, including the personnel itself, we went into the floor, which was full of spares, and went into some control area, which itself contributes into the flow and the response in terms of maintenance and so forth. And the story which could get there on the previous arrangement. And that story was very important because they could reflect into what has been a situation before the intervention was made at Tutuka, which had improved what one was talking about, the morale of personnel, which was greatly improved. People who could appreciate that indeed there has been some form of change. So I'm taking this model as probably what needs to be modeled going forward. You see, because an experience of failure to an experience of improvement to temper with availability factor, which somewhat is a positive story that should be carried through in what I think that the chairperson of the board referred to in a different form, but I would like to term it the quarantined problem instances. Because if you quarantine them, you would want to move them out as they succeed into various wards, like a patient, in a sense, of contamination. So it means that the stance of improvement, you would know where the problem, bigger problem lies. And then you begin to deal with the problem because you know where it somewhat resides, looking to other areas. So why are you not beginning into a bigger scheme of things to use that as your firmed approach in terms of getting into that kind of, because you have the success story? Two is what Mr. Ngumalo has referred to, that at some stage, Eskom would have taken trouble to want to look into expenditure to secure the supply of coal from the source. It's not your responsibility. I take it that you buy based on specification. If you buy and say, this is what I want, in terms of procurement, what ought to be delivered to you is exactly what you want. Whatever that comes there, which is not meeting the standard, should be discarded, should be turned back, because it's not of value in terms of your specification. And therefore, the trouble of securing coal should indeed, which I really wish appreciate, that should be the trouble from the source, which is to be the mine's problem to get into the point of use, which would be the receiving spot at Eskom, and then you deal with whatever comes that is. So you receive what you want. You know, you don't, I have to ensure that they transport this coal is safe, and they move with it. You spend time, you spend resource, you spend this and that, and your responsibility is just to receive that kind of a call. The third angle is the area which I think we have substantively dealt, I think my colleague dealt with. In a comparative instance, if you look into, I think you're saying in terms of these documents, the debt has come into a level of 424 billion rands. That is a debt for you to service. And if you look into your income revenue, as somewhat indicated there, is about 200 and. It's 200 and something. I think it's 266. Eh? Yeah, gross electricity revenue, 266 billion rands, and. Looking into that, you'd find that you are dealing with an institution which has got a serious problem. And then if you look into the commitment of government through fiscus, in the current form, which gets into some form of hope if it's handled appropriately, which might seek to bring a manageable financial position, if it's handled appropriately between yourselves and Treasury, it might then assist towards finding a lasting solution in terms of your own maintenance split. But there's a statement by the minister which always comes with that. The statement says, our main worry through action or whatever is about Eskom. It's not about energy. We always talk about Eskom. My own responsibility is to ensure that there is energy provision. What's your take, probably, Minister, on such in terms of variables that we want to deal with? Because institutionally, we are getting into unbundling. And if you are looking into the unbundling, the distribution in terms of your visible revenue split is in the positive compared to the negative of other two streams. And if then that is an area of worry, how would you guarantee that the sounding message is a message which carries the sustainability of the institution? So the cardinal instance of the survival of the institution to carry this function is somewhat guaranteed against a balance in as far as revenue or financial support to ensure sustainability going forward. Which is one of the areas. I agree with you on the municipal debt intervention. Even ourselves have been involved. We called everybody here from time to time to talk about that that debt. Now that we can find a commitment and solution, which is getting closer in solving that challenge. There's only one thing which is worrisome, as we from time to time deal with municipal ability to carry sound balance sheets. In a resounding form, you find that negativity sinks with the load of this Eskom debt. So the conditionality which is going out there, meaning that it should go together with working wholesomely to find that kind of a solution and to anchor the actual commitment in meeting the debt repayment by municipalities through some form of guaranteed assistance going forward. Because others, as we speak, are still sinking, but they carry a debt. So are these sort of guarantees, conditionalities, going to assist to what level? Have you begun to categorize that kind of gains out of such, so that you should not sit with the fact that there is commitment, and that commitment must be just commitment, because it can yield positive results going forward. So it might be that it's a call even to yourself, as it is a call to SALGA and everybody involved, that please create a categorized form of both immediate, medium to long-term benefit in terms of the commitment by Treasury to ensure that such guarantees would take you away from the current situation in which you are. The last area, Chair, is on supply chain. You know, the risk would always be there. That risk is going to be hanging on the success and the unfortunate situation which has been modeled behind Eskom failures. The more you deal with, you address the wrongs, the more you're going to be brought back to the operational deficiencies. So that the story of yesterday should be sustained. But if the beneficiaries who have planned their sustainability on your failures, there'll always be energy spent to cause failure. And if that failure is a risk to you, your sort of mitigation towards the sustenance of upkeep into your position. There's always this thing that says, in the appointment of a generation, you see, had reference to, which I held for the first when I heard about it. You see, once you do so, you are unfortunately bringing some kind of pressure, which is going to be unfortunate on the success. If I would simplify it on my language, you see, would have been the stretch of light and darkness attracts, you see, a whole lot of things to club and disturb that light in the darkness that has been yesterday. So what sort of a mitigation are you putting up in place to ensure that the disturbance from that success is not somewhat overwhelming your own recovery in a way? The Minister of Electricity is taking a tour in the country as we speak to various power stations. From others would have his hands up and say, see him disturbed by this and that, but the energy to ensure that things somewhat happen and improves. One appreciates that, which is the spirit that we must, all of us adopt to ensure that the country enjoys lasting improvement in as far as energy availability is concerned. How do you plan to mitigate that kind of risk? It might be that you indicate that you are taking care of it so that at least we should know that we're not going to be carried back into what we have experienced previously. But indeed, I would really want to say, Chair, we sit here to push you, to criticize you, to ask you right questions, and at times as if we're enemies. We don't want to see each other, but we want you to perform. It is in that way, even now, that we want you to sustain the improvement that we see from where you have been in the past. So, Minister, you have been given the names for the appointment of the CEO. They say they've given you the names. When are you appointing the CEO? Because leadership is one of the critical areas which assists organizations to move forward in terms of predictability. So that kind of a movement is a necessary movement. So the board is in your court to ensure that we create that a kind of an image that the country will not speculate, now would know that there is a leader for the executive in Eskom, and the performance would know in a predictable form that this is our leader, must look forward into ensuring that this executive is no longer having an acting individual. It has been too long now This is the CFO, not the CEO. So, not to push you back, but I appreciate your whole activity. But at least we must have that form of guarantee. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much. Let's get responses to the honourable list. Stand by.
Thanks, honourable. Tomorrow we'll just deal with the generations ones. And Martin can deal with the debt. I think then the minister has some, and then the municipal data, I think, again, as Monday has indicated, let's continue on this work with the National Treasury and SALGA and then see what benefits we get from the municipal debt. I think the two questions I want to just deal with and give input into, it's more like, I think, to also Honourable Van Meenen and Honourable Somyo. If you look at the financials and where are we going, is there light at the end of the tunnel? And if I just look at these losses for FY23 and the forecasted for FY24, on the back of that is this high expenditure of OCGTs sitting at 30 billion as a combination. My challenge to the business, and in particular generation, with the improvement of EAF, we must aim to halve that diesel cost. Diesel is not the fix to our supply issue in the country. It's improving the EAF in terms of the energy action plan of generation, but also, as the minister has indicated, we need more megawatts on the grid through connecting to the transmission and the distribution in terms of the different procurement windows as well as bilaterals. But so if we take the loss of 23 billion and 24 billion, for FY25, the challenge is spend 15 billion, half that diesel spend. So that's 15 billion you would add back to the loss. Then there are two other variables. The one around the municipal debt and the benefit that you can get through this incentive approach that National Treasury has implemented. And like Martin has said, of that 8 billion that we don't recognize, even if we recognize 50% more, that can give you 4.5 billion rand just from recognizing more revenue. And the last point is, through better performance and better EAF of generation, we are not supplying X gigawatt hours because of load shedding. So you're now then able to sell more in terms of volumes, and then you get a contribution from there. Our view is, through the better performance, you could, as a contribution element to our income statement, look to add about another 5 billion. So if you take 5 billion for more contribution with higher sales, you're saving on OCGTs of 15 billion. You potentially can get close to 5 billion from more Munich revenue being recognized. Then with all our other initiatives in terms of supply chain issues, better control measures, we are confident that those significant losses will be reduced by just those three key contributing factors. That doesn't mean we mustn't focus on our rest of our cost-saving initiatives. We will continuously drive that throughout the business. So that's the one point I wanted to add. The other one, with regard to this issue of morale, I'll give you an example. When I was on a visit to Kuburg with myself and Becky, and then the generation team, at that point in time, the UCLF was, I think, well over 18,000, and we were at the high stages of load shedding. We jumped on a call with all the power station managers, and we explained to them how unhappy we were. We reprimanded them and said, but we are disappointing not only Eskom, but the country. And it's important that you all need to come to the party, because the good performing stations now, you can't see that benefit filter through to the country if three or four stations drop the ball. And in a constrained generation supply, it's important that every station carries their weight. Otherwise, the good performing stations, you're never going to see the benefit. From that engagement, within about 4 days, Becky, if I can recall, they turned around at UCLF and it dropped, and we got about 4,000 to 5,000 megawatts back. But what we did as leadership, we don't only intervene when they're not performing, because they've improved and they turned it around and load shedding dropped significantly within a 3 or 4 day turnaround. We jumped on a call and we just spoke to them and thanked them. And I think that just the appreciation that, yes, when times are hard, you will hold us accountable, but also thank them for putting in the extra effort. And I think that, for me, that communication and transparency to show, yes, we will hold you accountable when you're not performing, but also thank you when you're performing. I think that morale, and Becky does a lot more of it when he deals with the business, I think that's coming through. The other thing I noticed in visiting Kusile with him, he doesn't only see generation as generation staff. He brings in the road tech staff. He brings in the contractors. So when we're discussing the recovery of the Kusile station, you got contractors, you got road tech and generation talking with one objective in mind. And seeing that, you know, myself as demonstrated one of the changes, you asked about what are the changes, Honorable Farmian, and I think seeing that in front of you and how it works, I think that has been positive. So I thought I would just give you some of those comments, but I'll ask Becky and them to deal with the other questions, and then we'll hand back to the Chair and the Minister. Thanks.
Thank you, Caleb. Chair, I think thanks for Somia as well for those remarks. I think I take it as something that we can take back as well as part of the lessons that we pick up from Tutua. I thank you for those contributions. I think there's a lot of sites that we are also, one of the things at Tutua, you'll recall that it was one of the stations that was earmarked for early shaft, and that had a tremendous negative impact on the employees. So one of the things we said to them, they must focus on their job, run the stations, so that we'd make it very difficult for anyone to make that decision when the country is battling. And some of the things that they've done it very well, I mean, we had our environmental review, because environmentally they were one of the stations that every month they were in conservation of some sort. And I must say the board operations chaired by Dr. Nyati before, they reprimanded us strongly as well. So I'm glad to report that for the past 3 months, then Tutua has got clean environmental contravention. So because it's all the things that the team take pride in what they are doing, and that's what we are encouraging, just to tap on what Caleb is saying. So definitely on the lessons, we are starting to spread them. You will see as well with Kusile, we have done the same thing. The two units that we have returned for a month now, running full capacity as well, you know, and the team is focused on that. And again, we have also placed someone experienced there who to deal with those issues. I think on the procurement, one of the things that we have also doing well as well, I must also acknowledge my colleagues from EXCO, you know, that we work as a team. Because the problem that we're experiencing is not a problem that I can deal with by myself within generation. So it's a Monday here because he's also got operations in this case. When he's around here, one of the deal we had is that he will go to Quebec. He can't go back to Johannesburg when Quebec has got issues there. So he's a second ESCO member on my behalf that also go to support the teams at Quebec to make sure that while this site is an ESCO member now, he still got the responsibility to support the teams. So that's one of the things. And then you've touched also on the commercial matter as well. You know, we work very well with the CPO in terms of assisting us to deal with some of the systematic issues. And one of the issues we have agreed on, which was creating a lot of leakages, is to address this issue of what is called informal tendering, you know, where people get three quotes, because that's where we pick up that we are sitting with a lot of issues that keep us busy for too long and focus on placing contracts there. The CPO, I'm not sure if you can want to add as well on that. But yeah, commercially, we continuously try to look at better ways to make our lives easier as well, because these are the things that can keep you busy. Then it becomes audit findings, and then you are stuck on that, and then there's not the time to focus on really what we have to do. So I think the support that we are also getting from our EXCO colleagues and the board is really helping us to stay focused. Thanks, sir.
Chair. Minister, Chair Minister.
The Chair is passing the buck this way. No, thanks for your remarks and observations, Honourable Somio. Now, I don't think I've ever made a statement that there's a distinction between energy and Eskom, because at the moment, Eskom does provide 90-odd percent of the electricity the country requires or is able to supply. So there are, if you like, various aspects to our function, some of which are shared with other colleagues in Cabinet. So if you look at procurement of additional megawatts, as I said, in whatever form that belongs to DMRE and NECOM monitors that. If you look at improving the generation system, you've heard quite a bit this morning about what the generation colleagues are trying to achieve, both at head office, but importantly, as it has been pointed out, at the power station level as well. Thirdly, complementing that with OCGTs, but basically purchasing diesel, and you can see that that's taking up a lot of money. If you look at the charts, a significant part of the 24 billion loss comes from the diesel side, and the fluctuation in both the exchange rate but also oil prices globally. And the current instability in the world, as I said earlier on, also impacts on that. Then there's the transformation of Eskom itself, as you pointed out, which is to implement the Eskom roadmap, but also the bill that is currently making its way through Parliament, the Electricity Regulation Act Amendment Bill, which will, if you like, complete the roadmap process and give us, for future generations, a new design, if you like, or framework for the electricity institutions and system in South Africa. In other parts of the world, this has taken a fair amount of time to bed down, and I imagine future generations will take care of that as well. So I think it's in that kind of context that you see the entire value chain and the different role players who have to ensure that that value chain functions. But ultimately, our goal must be that load shedding is not an impediment to business, not an impediment to growth, and not an impediment to job creation in South Africa, notwithstanding the kind of geoeconomics and geopolitics that's playing itself out over time. I think on municipal debt, you are right. Some of the municipalities are going to be able to comply. Others might not be, but as Mr. Bala pointed out, if we focus on the majority of the debt owing to Eskom, then the formula that has been arrived at by the Treasury and Eskom is one that should be given a chance to work, and that's a key as far as that is concerned. As far as the CEO is concerned, we've received the three names. I've been attending an investment conference in the U.S. I've just got back, and we now have to go through various processes within the government side as well. So we'll try and speed that up as much as is possible so that we meet our commitment that a CEO will be in place before the end of the year. On the supply chain side, I think the key message that even Parliament should join us in sending out is that we want value for money. That if we spend a rand, we must get one rand's value. And we shouldn't be spending a rand or 1,000 rand and getting 10% of the value at the end of the day. So it's in that sense the supply chain still faces, I think, significant challenges. And there are still people, as I said earlier on, who want to feed off that system because the supply chain or procurement bill within Eskom is quite a substantial one, particularly on the generation side, but there are other areas in the business as well that would have a similar impact as far as procurement goes. So we don't want free riders, people who are able to get tenders and then sell the tenders to other people for a commission of some kind, and all the kind of tricks that take place within the supply chain environment. What we want is value for money, and anybody who supplies that value for money should be entitled to deal with Eskom at the end of the day. How do we finally sustain the improvements that we've noted across Eskom? As the chairperson said, add urgency to what we're doing. Secondly, where the formula works, as you pointed out, and some of the colleagues have pointed out, replicate that formula elsewhere in the system and give feedback, even from Parliament, to the staff at power stations to say we acknowledge the progress that you've made, although we also at the same time recognize that there's a gap that we need to cover as we go forward. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Honourable Member, thanks for the question around the debt. And let me explain how it's going to work. In the past, Eskom had to use its cash from operations to fund its debt servicing costs. Now, the debt servicing costs has two elements. There's the capital portion and the interest portion that we had to pay. And the cash from operations were never enough so that we can service the debt. That means Eskom had to go and borrow money for the balance of the debt that you could not service, plus you had to borrow money for your capital program. Now, included in the capital program, besides finishing, is also the outage of generation. So we were never in a position that we can release funds for outages in advance because we were never sure whether we got enough money. What the debt relief is going to do now, the debt relief is National Treasury is going to give us the money to service the debt. So the cash from operations will now be used for your capital program, including the outages. So what we've already done with the outages for this year, we've already released all the funding for the outages. So Becky can now go and place long lead items orders for that. So that's how it's going to work. And also taking into account that Eskom was not allowed to spend any capex on new greenfield generation projects. We can spend money on the existing plant, but not new plant. And we're not allowed to borrow anything anymore, except for a few DFIs that's already in place that we can draw down from. So from that itself, and the fact that National Treasury is now going to give you the money to service your debt, our expectation is that come by 31st of March 2026, the debt will be less than 300 billion rand sitting on Eskom's balance sheet, which is manageable. I think the trick going into the future is to make sure that it stays at that level and that you don't go back to the higher level anymore. Thank you.
All right, Honourable Liz, over to you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the presentation and the answers already given. Mr. Chairman, I think it's universally recognized that the South African economy is in dire straits largely because of a constricted supply of electricity. It's not just about load shedding. Even if we had full capacity from Eskom, there wouldn't be enough to meet the requirements for, let's say, what was in the NDP of 5% growth. It simply wouldn't be enough. And so the discussion around the EAF, the energy availability factor, increasing from 56% to 60% is concerning. Given that that factor was 77% in 2018, surely our objective must be to get to those sort of levels, not just 65% by March next year, because one could argue that there are probably millions of South Africans unemployed as a direct consequence of the lack of electricity and consequently the lack of investment and development. The CFO has just, acting CFO has just made the explanation about the government debt assistance. And part of that is that there won't be any further borrowings except for some in the pipeline, small amounts. So I'm battling to get my head around the question of the 59.9 billion rand that was agreed to by National Treasury and how that really works. I know there's been an explanation as it's not direct borrowings, it's a whole lot of things coming together. But let's put that aside. So how does that moratorium on borrowing then impact upon the funding required for extending the transmission and distribution network? Let's assume that split finally happens and a separate company is established. Does that mean that the new company also cannot borrow any funds to extend the network? And if so, where are the funds going to come from? That network, again, I get back to the shortage of electricity generally. If we want to see a 5% growth rate, we need a massive increase in electricity supplies. And that can't come from renewables for baseload and so on, as we've heard this morning again. So where is the funding for that network extension to come from? Mr. Chairman, this whole municipal debt relief thing it's an inverse incentive. So municipalities who religiously paid their electricity are told, well, tough, you've paid, there's no incentive for you. And we give an incentive to those who are delinquent, hoping that they're going to pay their current accounts for the next 3 years, and then probably just fade back into not paying again, even if they are able to pay it. It just doesn't make sense. It's a short-term implementations, presumably to improve the cash flow of Eskom for 3 years, if it works. I have my reservations about that. But in the long term, it doesn't work. We've seen municipalities do this over and over again with rates, outstanding rates accounts, and they give up to 50% discount if you come and pay. And the people who've paid religiously simply have to carry on paying. They get no benefits. I'm fascinated by the Soweto write-off, 2.3 billion rand write-off, and it's the comments there, it's prescribed and in duplum interest. Now, why does that only apply to Eskom? Eskom supplies individual consumers in Soweto, and it's not supplying the Soweto municipality, which doesn't exist. So there must be consumers of Eskom, direct consumers of Eskom, throughout South Africa, whose debt surely has prescribed. Why are we just looking at Soweto? And how on earth does Eskom, with highly qualified accounting people, get into an indutum interest situation? Surely we know the law about the interest not being allowed to exceed the capital amount. How does that happen? I don't know. Perhaps I'm misunderstanding, so please correct me if I am. Mr. Chairman, then there have been 388 cases of discipline completed. The majority of those left, 168 I see. Mr. Chairman, what we've been faced with for my entire time in Parliament, which is now nearly 15 years, is repeated complaints about people moving from one government institution, department, entity, and getting jobs in others, despite their poor performance or whatever the reasons for them leaving the previous one was. So of these 388, have they been made public so that they don't get reemployed anywhere else in government or municipal government, or provincial government, any kind of government? And can we please get a list of the names of those 388 and a very short little comment about what the issue was with each of them, Mr. Chairman, so that at least we can get it out in the public domain if it isn't already out in the public domain. The question of Medupi, the coal heap at Medupi, we were fascinated when we were there to see all sorts of yellow equipment running up and down, grading, maintaining the coal heap. And it gets bigger and bigger. I assume it's getting bigger and bigger since we haven't been able to reduce or change the contract. So how much coal is in that heap as we speak? How many tons are sitting there? How long will that last, Medupi, should, let's assume, no further coal was purchased? Just what's lying there, how long would that last the power station, assuming full production and Unit 4 is up and running and no more blown up? And what is the cost of maintaining that coal heap every month? What's the monthly cost in yellow equipment, people, all the rest of the stuff that goes simply to ensure it doesn't wash away in storms or catch fire and burn out? What is the monthly cost? I assume that that's something that the CFO would know, given that it must be a massive cost. But otherwise, Mr. Chairman, we'd have to wait for a written submission on that. So, Mr. Chairman, let me leave it at that for now. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. If I may just piggyback on your one question so that it doesn't have to come back again, on the issue of municipal debt relief and the incentivization thereof. Because I see debt relief in the absence of consequence management for the municipalities, particularly around areas of revenue collection, where we know for a fact, and Minister will recall from your time at COCTA when you spoke about back to basics, where municipalities would collect revenue, but it would not deal with the core functions upon which it had been collected for. It was the classical case of borrowing from Peter to pay Paul. So I think there is clarity about around financial management reforms and restructuring and debt management in general in the municipal space, because I see this as precedent setting and may cause problems. because if you don't pay, the status quo remains, a relief will happen down the line. So it may solve the problems now, but I'm fundamentally worried about the sustainability of this intervention and what it means for ESCOM moving forward. And I only raise this, as I'm saying, I'm piggybacking on what Honorable Lisa said, because when we had the Minister of Public Works here, and you'll recall, colleagues, there was disputes even around the numbers. And then audit was to take place about how much is owed and all sorts of other things. I'm not sure whether that exercise was ever completed for us to arrive at this kind of intervention. And you've got municipalities that have made an effort to pay and to resolve their debt issues, whom had a series of problems. And whether their interventions of paying are sustainable or not, we don't know. So now when there's this, they'll begin to recognize, if you waited out long enough, this can. So I'm just echoing, really, I think there's a clarity that's required here. But debt relief in the absence of consequence management reforms, restructuring in the spaces where this challenge is taking place, may solve ESCOM's problems, but it does not solve the municipal problem, nor does it ensure that this will not recur moving forward. So I think maybe a discussion with COGTA and National Treasury moving forward may also be required to provide clarity on this modus operandi that's being employed and now. Thanks. Let's get responses to those issues.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honorable Lees. I'll start and Becky can come in and complement in terms of the generation performance. Yes, we aim to be at 65 in March 24, but then it improves by 5% EAF for each subsequent year. Then you migrate to 70% and then 75% by March 26. Fully agree with Honorable Lees. Like the Minister has said, as part of the Energy Action Plan, it's not ESCOM's performance only in terms of the energy and electricity issue to solve the country's requirements, but the importance of connecting more megawatts to the grid via the IRP and then unlocking on the transmission side. And then, Chair, maybe there I would ask Mr. Skiapas just to explain some of the initiatives we're looking to unlock the transmission grid while we can still expand in terms of the capital expansion for transmission. Then I would ask Monday to deal, supported by Martin, with the Soweto. And then also, Martin, you can deal with the CAPEX, how we're funding the transmission as well. So Becky, you can go first, and then Sekamotso, and then Martin can come in on the issues.
Thank you, Caleb. Yeah, I think you've touched on the increase on EAF, so I'm not going to go back to those ones, Chair, through you. Thank you. I think let me deal with the Medupi call. I think I'm happy to report that with an increased performance of Medupi, that excess coal has not grown in the past 2 years, because Medupi has been burning almost every coal that is coming through from the mine. So we have there about 17 million tons on that coal stockyard. If Medupi burn, if depending on the outages, it will burn that coal within a year, because it will burn almost 15 million tons, and I'm between 13, depending on the number of outages that are there. If we don't have major outages, it will burn within, but obviously, because of the current contracts, these contracts from the mine to offtake what is coming through, that's what we are trying to avoid. That's why you see now in the past also year as well, there was no take or pay issues as well at Medupi, because the station is running very well now. With Unit 4 coming back, it will even now at some point we'll be able to start drawing there, but it will take some time to, because the mine is also contracted to deliver around that 14 to 15 million per annum as well. So that balance. So we have got approval from the board to look for the selling of that excess coal as well, so that it doesn't stay there forever. So we are looking at those options. But currently it is not growing. So we are planning also to start utilizing smaller amount as well as we are moving forward. In terms of the maintenance, it's part of the normal running of the station because it's on the same footprint. So the same team that is maintaining the current stockyard is also doing the advantage is that it is compacted, so it doesn't change on a day-to-day. So, but there is a team that inspects it as part of the normal operations of the Metropicon stockyard. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Caleb. Good morning, Chair, and to the honourable members. With regard to the matters around unlocking the transmission grid, there's a number of plans that are afoot. Firstly, we have a 10-year plan where we are clear on where we need to develop new corridors, and the work to do the necessary EIAs, secure the routes and so on is in process, but that has got a fairly long lead time. So in the short term, there's a few things that we're doing. Firstly, we have identified various nodes on the transmission grid where we can add new transformers or additional transformers at the existing substations, which avoids the need for EIAs, the needs for long transmission routes. It becomes a local expansion, and we just add a transformer, and then we'll be able to connect more generation at those facilities. So that work has been done, and we are in the process of implementing the necessary projects. We will unlock around 13 gigawatts of new generation that can then be connected from the additional transformers. Secondly, we are finalizing an operational procedure that we term curtailment, which would allow us to be able to connect more generation again across the grid, but when we have excess energy to have the facility to then reduce the output from those generators. This is something that we have done fairly extensive research and consultations, especially with those transmission system operators where there's high penetration of renewables already. So it's a known technique, and it's something that we are seeking to employ. As we speak, we are finalizing those arrangements and also having some consultations with NESA. But it's something that we are very confident that we'll be able to implement successfully. And maybe just the last one regarding the funding. The CFO will speak more. But I think it's also important just to mention that for the next 3 years, the requisite capital investment has been secured and approved, and the focus is really on implementing those necessary projects. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman.
We'll just finish with the executives and we'll come to you.
Thank you. And I will continue where Sakhmotsos left off on the capital itself. So in terms of the TDP, the Transmission Development Plan, what we see, there's a slow build-up on the capital program itself because of the fact that you've got to do planning, you've got to do EIAs, you've got to place the order for the long lead items. So we are comfortable during the debt relief period that we can fund it from the cash from operations. We understand that after that, there will be a build-up. Now, after the debt relief period, there are various options that you can look into to fund it. There could be private participation in the program itself. There could be, if we go out and we were allowed to borrow again, you can now have specific lenders that is prepared to invest into the transmission and not the coal part of the business. So you can have, so there's a lot of options that we are busy looking into to see how we can deal with the funding of the capital program itself. Then the question around the Induplum interest in Soweto. Now I must make it clear that for accounting purposes, when we show our accounting records, we never include the Induplum interest because we realize it. This is a cleanup of the system only, where we in the system, we clear it out of the system because you identify, you investigate, and then you say, yes, it's right that we have to clean it out. And that's only a system issue, but from the accounting records, we never accounted for the Medupi interest in any case. I think on the coal, the Medupi coal cost, I think Beck has answered it. It's going to be very difficult for us to quantify it because you use the same equipment all over, it's the same people all over the plant. They're not specific to just one portion of the coal stockyard. Caleb, I think I've covered all the points. Thank you.
Sure. And just to Honourable Lisa's question on the cases and the names and a short write-up, we'll provide it in writing, Chair. Thanks.
Understood.
Just two aspects. On the last point about names and issues, I think the executive would be well advised to get some legal advice on the matter because these would be allegations. And the completed cases, that's fine, but you could be the subject of defamatory actions if you're not careful on that front. So just that concern for Mr. Lees to also take into account. And then to reinforce Martin's point about transmission, once the board is in place, all sorts of options are open, both in respect of funds that are available within the Eskom budget, but also possibilities, as he's indicating, outside as well. So, because we don't have 10 years to wait for the transmission lines to be developed, there has to be a faster approach, and that will be the subject of discussion by the new board of the company, the main board of Eskom, and colleagues in the transmission area. Thank you.
Just a request in the thing that will be sent in writing. When we were there in 2022 at Medupi, there was about 12 million tons stockpile, and the projection was that it would, by year end, we were there in April, that by year end it would be around 18, 19 million tons of stockpile. These are figures that came from Eskom. Now, I hear Zwita speaking about 17 million tons currently. So there's some sort of movement with the numbers. Can we get the tracking of that? When was it where and when was it where? Because it seems as if at some point you would have been taking in a lot of coal from 12 million to 18, 19 million. And now you're down to 17. So just clarify it month on month from then to now in terms of usage and where you were with the stockpile. So just think the numbers seem a bit. Right. Honorable Bukis.
Thank you.
I was just saying that in writing. Okay, sure, that's fine. Sweet. Yeah, thanks, Chair. I think the Minister reminded me that also obviously in terms of the coal, there is stock days that we need to maintain on the stockpiles as part of the grid code, which is about 20 days per station, but we will definitely issue that information, Honourable Chair, that you are asking as well on top of those ones. Thank you. Thanks, Minister.
Thank you very much for that, Honourable Bukis.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and thank you to the team for the presentation, and we acknowledge the improvement, and I think all of us agree that there's still a lot needs to be done. Chair, our last engagement with Eskom on recommendations was in January. I want to know, Chair, do they think our recommendations are feasible? And what is the process when you leave here? What is the process in Eskom from today till when we will meet again? And I think based on your answer, my second question will be then on if we, for example, say that we will go tomorrow to Eskom, will we be able
to track down the process that you follow after you meet with a SCOPA. Then secondly, Chair, in congratulating the chairperson with his position, I want to know, Chair, maybe I must just, because I'm Afrikaans, but in plain English, ask him, why did you accept the position? So, in your view, will you be able to change the situation? I think you mentioned three things in your input. One was the changing the speed of implementation. The second one is in continuous improvement, and the third one is in leadership. And Chair, just on a lighter note, there's a lot of pressure on Becky, not our Becky, that Becky. And I like it when he responds on some of the issues to say that we will work as a team. And that's leadership, Becky. So I think you prove us now that something will happen. But I want to know, Becky, was it in internal improvement? Not that one, not the Becky with the H, maybe it's only with the E. So was it an internal move, or where did it come from? And what happened there? So secondly, Chairperson, through you to the Chairperson of the Board, in changing the speed of implementation, what will you do differently? Then secondly, on continuous improvement, did you identify the reasons why it did not happen previously or in the past, and also why will it happen now? Then, Chair, most of you or my colleagues speak about the municipal debt. Mine is on the interaction with municipalities. Minister, most of the municipalities don't understand the real work, or why does tariffs change and things like that, and they don't know how to communicate it with our communities outside. So, except for the Municipal Debt Relief Program, are there planned physical programs with municipalities to interact with Eskom on tariffs and also to understand what is the reasons for load shedding, to communicate that to the communities? Then lastly, Chair, under Youth Employment Services, I see there is 523. So I want to know, is it you spread it over the provinces? Under gender equality, how many women are there? How long is this learnership? And what is the future plan in Eskom? If we go to our constituencies, Minister, there was a program of rural development, for example, trained youth and so on, but they are still at home. So is there a program, a future program in Eskom when that learnership ends? And then lastly, Chair, I'm not sure who was saying that they will look into load shedding during night. I don't know if we will ever, it will ever be the right time. But please look into it, Honourable Minister. That load shedding must be during the night because it's now matric exams and things like that. So all of us, maybe just us who are old, are sleeping between 12 and 5 at night. So I think that's the best time for load shedding, because we must live with load shedding now. So just to see how we accommodate all of us. Thank you, Chair.
I won't be drawn to the issues of age. Can we get responses to those questions?
Thank you, Honourable Bukas. So you gave me a number of questions. I'll start with the reason why I decided to take this job. As you probably can see, this job is not it's not something that is attractive. It's not an attractive job. It's the same as the CEO of Eskom. It's not one of those jobs that people wake up and say, "I want that job." But for me, having been on this board now for a year and being part of the team that has been working with management to put together the generation recovery plan to work on the restructuring of Eskom. I've seen the gains that we have made over the last 8 to 9 months, in fact, a year now. I've seen those gains. And I also can see how change can be so disruptive sometimes. So it was very important for me that we need to maintain and protect the gains that we've got and then continue to be doing those, making the improvements that we're expecting to be making as we go forward. So that's the first thing for me. This country cannot afford to go back. We have to move forward. And we've done things in a particular way, and those activities are yielding results. We need to protect that. And we need to provide the teams that are working and turning around Eskom with even more support. So from the position of the Eskom chair, I feel that I can be able to provide that support because I've been somebody that has been deeply connected with what is happening on the ground through the work that I've been doing for the board. I have visibility of many of the things that they are looking for from a support perspective. So that's the first big thing. Key, making sure that we maintain what we've got and provide the team the support. The second thing for me is I look at my own experience. I come from business, and most of the jobs that I've done over the last 25 years or so were jobs that are not popular, were jobs that are many people do not want them, were turnaround jobs, where you fix things. If there is any job that is about fixing, it is this particular one. You know, we have to fix Eskom. And we need people that at least have a sense of understanding of what is it that they do. There's no time for people to be learning here. So given that, I felt that it is the time for me to do my bit for the country to help with that process. So that's the second reason why I decided to take this job. And maybe the third one is really to feel that as a country, when I look at the people that I'm working with, when I look at that board, the commitment that they have around this country, the commitment that they have in helping to turn around this company, I felt we need to make sure that we give them, that board, the right platform through having a person who also understands them, the ability for us to make the necessary support and the changes that are required. So the key was this board, very strong board, that we have deep commitment, and let's make sure that this board has the kind of support that it needs to make the changes that it requires. So those were the key reasons for me that made me to decide to take this job. It's not an easy job, but I also know that I'm not alone. I've got a very strong team in terms of the board. I also got a very, very strong management that is committed, and we have also have a demonstrated track record over the last year in terms of turning things around. So those were the key reasons for me. So what will change in terms of the continuous improvement? What is going to change is, look, for me, it's not something new. It's something that we have been already doing. Having a board that is engaged, having a board that is having tough conversations if required with management, having a board that is able to go and have tough conversations with the shareholder on behalf of management if that is required, you know. And those are the things that we'll continue to do, and we do, because that's what is required. Management, not most of the time, they are looking for us to help them to remove some obstacles. we have to go and help them to do that. And that is what we have to actively be doing that. But at the same time, we have situations where there are commitments that are made and people are not delivering on those commitments. We cannot sit and say, okay, we are happy with that. We need to have tough and difficult conversations with management around that. But at the same time, when things are done properly, we need to find a way of motivating them and helping them to understand that things are done in the right way. So that is the board that we are going to be having, a board that I call it, we're providing tough love. We love our team, we love our management, but at the same time, if we have to have difficult conversations, we're not going to shy away from having those difficult conversations. And they know that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jesse. Honorable Bierkes, just some of the other questions. I think firstly, in terms of communicating with the municipalities in terms of tariffs and explaining load shedding through Monday Bala, definitely can arrange that through his engagement as distribution. And as we said, it's a team, and I'm sure Bierke will be supporting him on explaining load shedding. On the YES initiatives, I'll ask Elsie Poulet to elaborate on your questions on that. And maybe just last but not least, yes, Becky Numalo is internally from Eskom. We did follow a recruitment process. There was also external candidates, but going through it and supported by the board, we decided to go with Becky Numalo, and we can see now the benefits of choosing someone that understands the Eskom operations and the power stations, but also understanding how low-tech works as well. So I'll see if I hand over to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Caleb. Thank you, Chair, honorable members. The number that you see there in terms of the YES program is just one of the small parts we're doing around skills development, particularly building the pipeline. On the YES program in particular, there is an obligation that you focus on those who do not have a post-matric qualification. We bring them at the bottom of the organization. A big chunk of that, we do have an obligation to absorb them as part of our job creation initiative. So we do have other pipeline initiatives in terms of bursaries for artisans, for technicians and engineers. We don't necessarily hire everybody, but we do commit in terms of making sure that by the time they complete, they've got a portable qualification. Thank you.
I think on the question of interaction with the municipalities on the issues you've raised, Mr. Bala is in the right position to tell you at the regional stroke provincial level what kind of interactions occur with municipalities. And from my experience with him and his team, they seem to have a fairly good relationship with most municipalities that want to get things done. The youth issue has been dealt with, the load shedding at night, perhaps Becky can come back to that and address that as well. And where does Becky come from? So you're going to tell the committee which tree you plucked him from. But he was formerly in generation, then in Rotec and back in generation. So he's been around Eskom generation for many years now. He can make a confession to you if you want that. That will help you. And then perhaps the acting CEO can also look at what do you do with the recommendations, that, and then what is the process that you actually follow. But we take your point that constant communication with the public is absolutely important. So that, as you say, they understand why load shedding now and how best can we manage the load shedding so that it has a minimum impact both on the economy but also on society as well. Thank you.
This is the part where I'm now starting, of course, asking for pointed responses.
because a week or two ago I was advised that our meetings need to end on time. That, so, GCE, just on the recommendations from COPA, definitely as a management team, we take it seriously. We've seen the benefits of these interventions, and importantly, also from a board perspective, they also hold us accountable in terms of these recommendations. Thank you. I'm not sure if Becky wants to add to where did he come from and how long.
On law enforcement colleagues, they are appearing before us on the 22nd of November. So some of these issues that have been ventilated here and are in the update report, they are for the 22nd. So I think let's keep our eye on that. Honorable Mende?
Thank you very much. Chair. I think I'm going to first pick it up where it was left off on the two matters. One of the rising municipal debt as well as the relief that has been provided. I listened to the response. However, there is still no tangible plan as to how do we then prevent the citizens from accumulating more debt, which is going to be costly to Eskom, as well as the issue of the monitoring of the debt itself. What are the systems in place? And what is it that we're going to do differently so that the citizens do not accumulate debt? But that goes also with the indigent policy of Eskom. Because citizens that do not have much, in particular people that are dependent on the grant system, or ordinarily are supposed to be compensated also from the part of Eskom. You can't give them grant as a government and still ask them to pay for electricity. So there was a compensation of certain units for households of such people. However, that system, I don't hear it working very well, especially as part of the resolutions to people accumulating debt when they cannot afford it. That plan, can we hear it once more time? The second part is considering the answer, which was not clear as well in terms of our new in charge, Ubeg. Yeah, welcome to the hot seat. I'm particularly not happy because, and I'm not going to be very lenient on this one. We give positions of high power at Eskom and pay a lot of money to very useless people. But when it comes to other people internally, when they are being moved around, then there is no compensation for the work that they must do and what is expected of them. They are expected to turn around Eskom. So I want to understand exactly. I think when my colleague was asking where is Becky coming from, she was actually asking, was he promoted to the position that makes him answer questions today on the mess of other people? So that when he comes back here, we hold him accountable properly on a position that is paid for and he must be accountable for. We cannot be expecting him, and I'm going to be very much a black conscience on this one. When it comes to black brothers, we ask arrangements. When it comes to white people, we give them promotion. And that cannot be accepted. So that question of where is Becky coming from,
and how did he end up where he is today? It must be clear. The answer must be straightforward. And if it's not straightforward, we must be given reasons as to why. Number three, there is a thorny issue. There are certain days where load shedding disappears, and in particular for certain activities. Most recently was for the Rugby World Cup. Beautiful thing. We had to watch our boys playing. But now we are having children. I hear what my colleague is saying. We are having children writing exams, and they are subjected to darkness, even during the day when they are writing exams. They are subjected to disruptions. And I know for a fact that basic education has not given them alternative energy in terms of sustaining the energy supply to whatever is necessary to them, either it's light or it's computers or whatsoever that they have to use. Why has ESCOM not considered giving schools electricity during exam time? Because we're talking about the future of the country, at the same time, we don't care about them. Why are we not providing full electricity supply when it comes to exams, especially for the matriculants? And we know very well that majority of them, they come from the families that do not take from anything. They can't even afford to have those lamps. That's the most effective lamp, doesn't cost anything less than 300 rand. Yet ESCOM cannot afford to now give them electricity so that they are able to study and write peacefully. And I want to understand also the plan on excluding schools from this load shedding. That goes with hospitals and any other essential service. Because essential services like hospitals and schools, we are directly disrupting the future of many, many people. Imagine when the lights are going to go off and there's a woman who's giving birth. What's going to happen? And all that we can say is sorry. But in any way, you're accumulating a lot of lawsuits because of that. There's many people who are now challenging and putting claims against ESCOM on the basis of the load shedding and its negative factors. Yeah, and I would like to hear from Obeki on the issue of this generation, because as much as we talk about the debt and the relief that the government is providing, if we continue to spend carelessly on generation, in particular where IPPs are concerned, and we know how expensive they can be, how are we going to balance that? Because if we are now taking the generation from ESCOM and ask someone else to generate electricity, whom they are going to be a business and want to make profit, especially private sector because they are profit driven, how are we going to balance the balance sheet of ESCOM in terms of expenditure and ensuring that we are not accumulating debt as ESCOM? And there was a response on the issue of transfer of skills from the OEM. In the same vein, on one of the documents you've given us, when you were answering 6.23 on the recommendations that were given to you by the committee, and you went at length explaining how the OEMs are transferring, yet you could not respond to Kusile 3 units. Unit 1, 2, 3 were out in October, and then
They were back in October 2022. They were back October 2023. And there's one unit that is not accounted for. And I don't understand then when you speak of transfer of skill and the issue of the FGDs, which is also cited as an attributing factor to why those units were out at Kusile. We are running in circles. There isn't much that Kusile is doing. It keeps tripping, and we cannot fix the problem. Can we hear clearly, can we now have someone who can attend to an FGG in Kusile, or we don't have that person? Because that's our main contributing factor when it comes to Kusile. The FGGs are what causes the units of Kusile not to return as soon as possible to the grid. Do we now have people that can attend to it as soon as possible? And that speaks to how the OEMs are transferring the skill back. And also talking to the contract as it was signed. There was a time when the environment minister attempted to deal with that matter, and how far is that? And also there was an exclusionary contract and terms where Medupi is concerned, because Medupi's contract was also, loan contract, was also affected by the issue of the FGGs. There is ABB, and I saw a lot of contracts that were cited which were owing Eskom. Some of them were overpaid. Have now since been terminated. There are some that are not terminated. And there's ABB who keeps being a thorn. And ABB is stable at Eskom. No one is talking about anything about them moving. The response of Direte, that was, I think, last year, was because they must finalize some business. But they are still finalizing some business, and they are continuing getting our money, even though they have confessed themselves that they were corrupt. And they entered into corrupt deals with officials in order for them to do business with Eskom. Yet they are still in the payroll of Eskom. They are still doing business. Why is ABB still there? Can we get a proper answer? And when are they getting out? When are they leaving? Because these are not just sincere and honest business people. These are corrupt individuals and thugs. They even managed to buy their way out through paying some fine to the state through the NPA on some flimsy explanation. So can we also get to understand why is ABB still there and when is it getting out? The coal mine for Kusile. We still have trucks. I hear the solution of a conveyor belt, but the conveyor belt is also not convincing because it's not coming from a mine to the Kusile, the power station. It's coming from the stockpile to the power station. The trucks are still bringing. When are we having a mine for Kusile? How far is that process? Because we were told at some point that the process was undertaken, Treasury said this and whatever. When are we going to have a mine for Kusile? Because it's a coal power station and it must have a mine so that we are able to cap some of the expenditures. My last one, Chair, and which is very, for me, very problematic. The planned outages. 21-22 you planned 79. Then 22-23 you planned 54. And I'm asking myself, it looks like the same units that have been dealt with in one financial year, they get planned again for outage in the next financial year. So how long does it sustain each unit, a proper maintenance that has been done? How long does it sustain it? Because it looks like every year we plan outages for all the units. And even if this year those units are maintained, everything is done, next year they are planned again. And we're never going to get out of load shedding. It's going to be perpetual if that's the case. It looks like we don't have a proper maintenance plan which can sustain each unit for at least 5 years so that we do not have to disrupt the provision or the supply of the energy throughout. For now, Chair, I'm fine. Thank you.
Very much. Yeah, can you just get clarity on New Largo coal mine at Kusile? Because from 2019, we were, just to amplify, Honourable Member, we were there in August 2019, and we were told that January 2020, everything would be signed, and it will all be hunky-dory. 4 years later, it has not happened. 700 trucks, and I'm sure it's more now, driving to Kusile every day, delivering coal. Yet the very reason why Kusile was built where it is built is because there's a mine there. We can't keep on having this conversation, particularly in light of what the SIU has told us, that there are syndicates operating in the trucking industry and so on and so forth. So the delays, Mr. Chairman, in resolving that particular issue is problematic for us. I'm just amplifying what Honourable Mentor said, because this is a matter that has been on our radar, and I would imagine has been on your radar since the commencement of the construction of Kusile, where it was, with the logical outlook that when construction was done, the mine would be ready. It has not happened. And here we are again, still dealing with this. Right, can we get responses to that?
Thanks, Honourable Chair, Honourable Mente. I'll ask Monde to deal with municipal debt, specifically dealing with the mechanism of FBE, how it's working, and then also Monde, if you can touch on the load shedding, you know, for schools, hospitals, essential services. Then Becky, you will deal with the Kusile, and Dan can support you on New Largo. Plan outages, ABB, OEM, IPP spend, and then if Winile can just deal with lawsuits with regard to load shedding and where we are. And then, yeah, and then you'll deal with Becky Aboin. Winile?
Thanks, Kelly. Thank you, Chair. Honourable Mente, yeah, just on the issue of municipal debt and the accumulation of more debt by communities, I think we need to start off by saying this debt relief is not a silver bullet on its own. It will give us a short-term relief whilst we're sorting out the industry, the distribution industry restructuring, which is a process that we have undertaken through the MECOM structures with being ESCOM, with SALGA, with the AMEU, with DMRE and TPE. And COPTA as well. So that process is currently underway, and yeah, it will take a bit of time because we need to deal with the structural issues affecting the properly run municipal electricity businesses, so that then it talks to the sustainability of that sector. On the issue of an indigent policy, ESCOM does not have an indigent policy. ESCOM implements the indigent policy. That is a government policy of the free basic electricity. So at this point in time, the free basic electricity, each indigent household gets 50 kilowatt hours that would then be allocated to them. The challenge that we have experience with this, with the application of this indigent policy, is that it is administered through the same municipalities, the same ones that you are currently challenged. So what you are seeing is that where the municipality has got other challenges, administration is one of those challenges that they have. So yes, the communities that are within those municipalities that are supposed to be benefiting from this indigent policy, they're actually not benefiting. The second point to this is that when this 50 kilowatt hours was introduced, it was probably about a decade or two ago. We have submitted recommendations that this 50 kilowatt hours be upgraded to 100 kilowatts. It is a conversation that we are currently having with COCTA, with National Treasury, with SAGA, so that again, once we sorted out the administrative part, then we deal with the issues of substance, which is the quantum of the relief itself. With regards to the critical installations such as schools and hospitals and exemptions to load shedding, those we do as a matter of course, and those we do as a matter of as and when things are required. I'll give you an example. With the start of the exams, the first exam that was written, the matric exams this year, fortunately at that point in time we didn't have load shedding. It was an IT exam, but at that point in time there was no load shedding throughout the country. But what we had done is throughout the country, we had, from time to time, what we'll do is we'll, depending on the installation and whether or not we can exempt them from load shedding, but if there's alternatives that we can provide, we do provide those alternatives. There is a process that we need to comply with in terms of regulation and how we implement this load shedding. Let me just also add that load shedding is not just implemented by ESCOM or in ESCOM supply areas. In the main, schools and hospitals are within municipal supply areas, but as distributors themselves, they need to do their own load shedding. So in terms of making local arrangements, those should be done so with the respective local authorities, and I'm certain that depending on the circumstances of the time, that those arrangements can be made. Unfortunately, load shedding is a function of what is available on the supply side from the generation side and what is being consumed at that point in time on the demand side. So if there's a mismatch, then you have load shedding. So, and it's not driven by events such as the World Cup. No, it's just at that point in time what is available in the demand and what is being consumed. So, sometimes it does coincide. But as far as best as we can, we avoid load shedding, and specifically on critical infrastructure, at critical times as well, such as the times of writing exams, we make local arrangements, but those must be made with the local authorities. Thank you, Chair. Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you, Honorable Mente. I think maybe let me start with the question you have raised in terms of spending carelessly in terms of our maintenance approach. So one of the things we are doing, because we agree with you that our job is to make sure that the current fleet is working correctly as well. So I must also thank the board as well. We have been now given money, because one of the things, that's why you see some of the outages coming through and through, is that if you do not have the money to do everything, you do what you can, and then you end up with the problems as well. So now we are including the stations that, like the Henrinas and the Hotleys and all of those things. So we are now spending on them. Ours is to improve our performance, because we believe that with that, whoever comes in terms of the competition, their price needs to be lower than us for the dispatch. So that is what we are talking with the team to focus on, to say, focus on what we have, run the stations correctly, and then the rest of the other decisions will have to be made based on the financial model. So we fully agree with what we are saying, that ours is to improve the current ESCOM performance. That will put us in a better position. And then we are also, I must thank also the support that we are giving, we are also starting now to participate in some of these other clean energies. You know, we will be opening our first battery storages this week as well with our minister, because we have just completed as well from ESCOM, which is one of the bigger things. And then On the point you raise about OEMs, I think we always pick up the lessons as well, specifically at Kusile when it comes to FGDs, because what happened, the OEMs will build and then they will hand over to the generation team, but most of the areas like the boilers, turbines and other plants, because they were similar across the other fleets, we never have these difficulties that we had at Kusile. So with the FGDs, the lessons that we've picked up now, we have already signed a 5-year contract with the OEM, which is GE. They are currently on site as well, working with our teams. And then one of the things as well, when we got back, we said to the station management that let's stop moving people around. This is a specific plant. We need to make sure the dwell time of our people, be it operating maintenance engineers, they are not get moved around within. It's also that we create that skill space as well. So I think we think that, and then we will do the same thing at Medupi. So one of the lessons we are putting in now at Medupi, which is that the OEM who's going to build the new plant at Medupi, they will have to operate themselves with us. So part of that, of the contract, is that first 5 years, they must also build, operate for the first 5 years together with our teams, so that it is a smooth handover and lessons from that. So in terms of the approval from the Minister of the FFE, we've got approval to run the first step, because Kusile currently we have returned them with the temporary stacks. So we've got approval to run that station without the FGDs, the first three units. So that is up to 2025, because that's when we envisage that the main stack will be finished. The contractor is busy now, after they completed the temporary stack, to enable us to return the first two units. The third unit we are busy with, it is part of the stack. If you recall that when the scope was there, we were talking about returning the first unit end of December, because we have accelerated the schedule. So the third unit is still in the process of being returned. They are finalizing the tie-in, because it's in between the two units, so they need to connect now between these other two units. Once that work is done, we'll commission that unit, and then it will also return. I'll come back to ABB now. Let me go back to the new Lago mine. I think you'll notice there that we've indicated that Seriti, one of the things when Seriti changed, this mine changed from Anglo-American. Unfortunately, my colleague then fell sick, now he had to leave. When it changed from Anglo to Seriti, then Seriti also wanted to do their own due diligence. That was one of the delays that happened. And then also one of the recommendations from Scopa, honorable member asked if we are taking those ones seriously, was that we needed to deal with the coal quality issues as well. You recall that when Scopa was there, the issue of coal qualities at Kusile was one of the issues that was raised. So when the mine came in, we then strictly said they we specify the coal that we need for those boilers, that we will not compromise on the lower spec on that. So then they needed to make sure that, then Seriti said then they needed to rework their own, which they have done now. We have already, they have opened part of the first operations of the mines, which is that pit A, H and D. It is operating, they are still supplying with conveyor. The conveyor that I spoke about, that we've got approval that they are building, it is a mine conveyor, not only on the stockyard. It's a belt that is coming now from the mine. In terms of their own operations, it's going to tie it in, and then it will come to the station. So the current indication is that they should be finishing by the end of 2024, commissioning early 25. Then we should start using that coal conveyor. It will interface then with the station conveyors inside the station. But the mine is busy now with that, and then they will start developing the whole other mining operations. But based on the quality requirements for Kusile, the mine itself, I think they will only be able at full production to supply about 70% of the Kusile requirements, because Kusile at full load, we also need about 15 million tons per annum. So the mine will not get into that. So we still need to have some levels of tracking. That's why the infrastructure that we are putting is not going to be sterilized as well with that. So Chair, that hopefully that clarified. So I think I remember, Chair, you did indicate that you wanted to stand on the mine. I think on next time you are there, we are happy to take you to the pits that are already in operations as well, because I think it's also the assistance that we got from Scopa to see why are we accepting. Because sometimes you compromise and take the lowest paid coal, and then we sit with the more problems from site, and we have refused that one with the mine now to say they must give us the coal that we need. Now, the issue of ABB, I think my colleagues from legal will also assist there. The ABB from the project side, and Zandi is also here, we have, and I think now the papers were submitted to the judge in terms of terminating the current contract. And then obviously the other complications with ABB is that they've got a vast installed capacity across Eskom, not only in generations only. So the spares and all of those things, that's what we're dealing with. But in terms of the new contracts going forward, I think it's something that we've been engaging with our teams. I think the commercial teams can also engage to see how do we deal with that, because it would be difficult to cancel the current contract. At Kusile, also in agreement with National Treasury, we have agreed that today we need to allow them to complete the projects at no profit, which they have signed on as well. So yeah, because we still got Kusile Unit 6 that we need to bring on. So there is no profit that they have signed on at Kusile, and that's what my colleagues here, Zandi and the team, they monitor that. That ABP is not going to make any profit at Kusile, but they need to finish, because to start a new contract, it was going to cause us more delays and more claims from the other contractors there. So I'm too sure that to you, Caleb, if we need, they can also touch on gently in terms of going forward with ABP.
Thanks. To you, Honorable Chair, Winnie, you can just touch on the question of lawsuits, maybe ABB, and then I'll answer the IPP one before I hand over to the Chair.
Thank you. Good day to the committee members and good morning to the Chair. My colleague Becky has addressed the ABB issue in terms of what arrangements have been made insofar as the contract is concerned. There is litigation that Eskom is working with the SIU on in terms of the ABB contract and setting it aside. However, there is a decision that was taken, as Becky has indicated, that ABB will be allowed to finalize the current contract. We are looking at new contracts coming into play and whether or not they'll be allowed to participate in that. However, we have started with the litigation in consultation and in assistance from the SIU in setting aside that contract. So from a legal perspective, we are dealing with the contract that has been concluded with ABB, and we'll be able to give direction as we finalize the litigation. And insofar as the supply, internal supplier reconsideration process is concerned, the decision has been taken that we will await the outcome of that litigation before we finalize the internal process in the supplier reconsideration and whether or not they'll be allowed to tender for new work going forward, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. With regard to IPPs, I think through the DMRE procurement processes, many of that is non-dispatchable renewables, which effectively through the NESA mechanism, it's a pass-through to Eskom. So we do acquire that. There sometimes is a time lag in terms of when IPPs come online, especially if they come earlier, in terms of determinations. We recover that through an regulated clearing account mechanism. The ones that are dispatchable in terms of Avon and DESA, again, there's rules and mechanisms around those load factors. So under IPPs, effectively, we follow the outcomes of a DMRE procurement process and then what's allowed to be recovered through the MYPD NERSA process. We have seen in the later bid windows that the PPAs for renewables has decreased in the latest bid windows. Obviously, the overall weighting with the first and second bid windows, those prices were at premiums, so you still have that weighting that does then lift up the average price until those are completed. These are 20-year PPAs. Chair, that's IPP 1, and I'll hand over to the chairman.
And thank you, Chair. The point that I want to address is around the appointment of Becky Lamalo, and as the group executive for generation. I want to point out from the outset that Becky did not raise his hand for this job. We approached him. He was approached when we became clear that the candidates that we're looking at, none of them would be able to do the job that we felt was required. So we decided to change tact and look internally and see if we do not have people in within the organization that can really do this work. And Becky's name came through that process. So the reason why I'm explaining that he did not raise his hand, he was approached because he, as the assertive person that he is, he was very clear that, you know, if I were to take this job, these are the things that needs to be addressed, and these are the conditions, the kind of support that I need. He was very clear about that. And the good thing is now you can see he's got the job, and it's because largely all of the things that he asked us to do were done. So I will leave it at that, Honorable.
Thank you very much, Honorable Zibula. No. Bamba. No. Bamba. Honorable Zibula.
Thank you very much, Chair. All protocol observed. We are going to sing the same song about Latin expression. When is going to be completed? What action are you taking for those people who are refusing to comply? I thank you.
So this is one of those things. The vetting for us is a non-negotiable. If you are a board member in ESCOM or an executive in ESCOM, you cannot say that you do not want to do it. You know, you have to go through it. And from a board perspective, we say that we need to lead by example. We need to set the tone around this. And it's clear to all board members that they have to go through it, and they are going through that process. Many are at different stages of the process, but all of them are engaging with the process, and we'll make sure that they do. So there is no room for people to say they are not going to do it.
I think maybe there's something a bit more concrete than that in terms of the process and the way it's working. I just have one question because of the time is against us. In the House, I happened to pose a question to the Minister of Electricity. It was on issues around procurement, and he expressed some sort of issue about one thing or other. The question is not material to this conversation. But it got me wondering, because at some point he said, of course, he can't interfere with procurement processes, which is elementary. But he would hope that ESCOM would deal with the issues that we'd been raising. So I've been wondering since then, probably been about a month, what's the nature of the relationship between ESCOM and the Minister of Electricity? I raise this in the context that there's
seemingly parallel pronouncements that take place, the latest being bonuses for workers if for Christmas if things go right. And then there is these, it was on one of the radio TV stations, Newsroom Africa, if I'm not mistaken, I can pull the transcript up. Then there's these visits to power stations, right? And then there's weekly updates to the nation about the electricity challenges. And the question becomes, who's the authority on the electricity matters and the functionality of ESCOM? Because it's necessary to gauge progress. Who's who in the zoo? So you've got ESCOM, you've got a shareholder in the form of DP, in the shareholder of the minister, and you've got the Minister of Electricity. And I think it's important to unpack this relationship and this in the nature of this new construct in terms of the accountability processes, the operational processes, because you've got the executives here, Obamumalo, are busy, and then you have got a political appointment also now in the mix of things. At a particular level, it does provide a semblance of confusion. Now, I raise this because my attention was drawn to this thing about what if the workers do, and I'm asking, does ESCOM's financial position allow for that kind of situation? It just got me wondering. I've been grappling with this thing for the past month, and it came to a head when this thing now came out, and I was like, it will cause an unnecessary confusion in terms of the oversight and accountability processes we are engaged in. But I think it's only fair for us to understand, because then it means at some point we must interact with the minister on the issues that he's raising, which have got a material bearing on the long journey we have traversed. Which is common in Malama bonus, you know, coming out of a report which even today is speaking about losses, technical and otherwise. So I think it needs clarity, and I'm really putting it to yourselves, Minister and the Chair, the nature of the relationship, how is it structured, what agreements are in place, if there are any, and where is this ministry located in the greater scheme of the body reality of ESCOM. Thanks.
So, Chair, that ministry is a special measure introduced by the President in the context of the electricity crisis we faced. Secondly, in the President's pronouncements, various roles were assigned to the Minister responsible for mineral resources and energy, electricity, and then public enterprises. From a DPE point of view, we remain the shareholder that has overall responsibility, but the Minister of Electricity has two key areas. One is to optimize the performance of the current plant, and I imagine he interacts with people like Becky Nomalo in his at some level in relation to power stations, but secondly plays a role in terms of the National Energy Crisis Committee, which, as I said earlier, has about 8 or 9 work streams, and then presents a report on behalf of the presidency in that particular regard. If there is to be any financial measures taken, ultimately the board has to be consulted on those measures, and as you correctly point out, whether given the financial position of Eskom, which measures would the board support and which measures would they not support. I imagine in terms of parliamentary protocol, you are free to invite anybody you deem appropriate to present themselves to you and respond to any issues, but we will also raise the issue that you brought to our attention with him so that we can get the appropriate clarity that that you seek. Thank you very much.
We are under time constraints. I think what we'll do is we're going to send a set of follow-up questions in writing. Colleagues, any questions that you have, please send them through to so we can transmit them to ESCOM latest tomorrow afternoon, and then we can get those written responses by next week Friday as we also close up our own work for the year. So I would like to take this opportunity to thank the Minister and the Board, and to say, Chair, we've heard what you have said and all your commitments and noble intentions in assuming the office of Chairperson, and to say that the taste of the pudding is in the eating. Ours is to hold you committed to your own commitments and the other applicable plans that ESCOM has engaged in. All we want is stability at a leadership level, because stability provides certainty. And at this point in time, we remain, we are left with skepticism when there is sort of a revolving door at the leadership level. And so hopefully the process of the appointment of the CEO will move with the kind of speed and receive the urgent priority attention it requires to meet the commitment of a CEO being appointed by the end of the year. It's all about stability and ensuring that we can peg the outlook of oversight and accountability around certainty, and that certainty first and foremost is not in plans but in those tasks with the implementation of those plans, and that's at the leadership level. So it's urgent that this issue is sorted, because once one person acts, then it becomes a layer, because then other people have to act at other positions and at other structures. So we hope that it will be sorted. We will look at the responses again, and I'm sure we will be scheduling a proper full hearing on the audit outcomes at a later stage to ensure that we tie down on ESCOM matters. The final announcement, colleagues, and then I'll hand over to the Minister for any concluding remarks on the Chair, is tomorrow we will be getting a briefing from the AG. We're meeting virtually at 9:30. On the medical legal costs that the Department of Health is faced with and the litigations thereof. So AG is briefing us on that. Then next week, water and sanitation on Tuesday, a follow-up to the oversight to Limpopo. And then on Wednesday, we do know that it's an ESCOM-related matter, the appearance on the basis of subpoena of Brigadier Berger after a series of refusals, and then ultimately that subpoenas we have issued. I'm advised that there's discussions between Parliament Legal and his legal team on some aspects of that subpoena. So, but as things stand now, the meeting remains scheduled. I mean, the subpoena was accordingly served on Brigadier Berger. If there's any change, we will advise accordingly. So that is where we are. Chairperson, I'll start with you, and then I will go to the Minister.
Thank you so much, Chair. I will be brief, Chair. What I will say is that first and foremost, as both the board and as ESCOM, we take our engagements with this committee, we take it very seriously. And we have had now a track record or an experience of working with you, and through those engagements what we can see is an ESCOM that is getting better. We're getting feedback, we're getting the kind of bad news that we sometimes may not want to hear, but we need to hear, and we're hearing those from you, and that helps us to become a better organization. So we appreciate these sessions, and rest assured, when we leave here, we go back and we look at what needs to be done, and we drive those actions. So as you say, that the proof will be in the pudding. As we go forward, our commitment is that we want to accelerate the rate at which we are implementing actions. You will only be able to see that the next time we get here, but I can commit that that's what we will do. You know, this team is very, very focused on driving the actions. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chief Minister.
So, Chair, thank you for the interaction, and as I said earlier, it will be good to have the committee acknowledge the kind of work that is happening on the ground at a power station level, which is demonstrated through the improvements that the Chair of the Board is referring to, and to pick up Honourable Somyo's point that a kind of positive reinforcement is quite important. Secondly, that we're making daily progress, again, in a context where there are still lots of difficulties to resolve, but the progress is a discernible one. Thirdly, on the municipal debt issue, I mean, there are lots of interactions with all of the parties concerned, and notwithstanding the skepticism that some of us have, I think let's give that an opportunity to work and see what best we can do. Fourth, from a shareholder point of view, we would certainly ask the board to have a very clear plan to build on the successes so far, to, as the Chair said, apply a new sense of urgency in executing certain of the projects. And here, as he also says, both the committee and others in terms of what the country requires at this point in time. But I think there are a whole lot of positive things that are to come in terms of restructuring of ESCOM, in terms of meeting the climate change challenges, and keeping the operations to a point where we can actually say in a few years' time that we have surplus energy in South Africa and energy security, which must be our overall commitment to the country and to the economy. So thank you very much for this interaction.
Thank you very much. I think, colleagues, this being our last interaction for the year with ESCOM, it would be remiss of me if I don't thank you, colleagues, for all the hard work you've put in on the ESCOM space this year. I think we've traversed a very long journey and have understood the issues better, and we have been able to provide the necessary parliamentary oversight that's required on top of the issues that we've got an ongoing engagement on the Derita allegations. They help, but I really just want to say thank you to you, colleagues. I think you've handled all these ESCOM matters very well. When we had lunch, which we now invite you to, I will tell you a joke about a South African in a tunnel. The meeting stands adjourned.
Thank you, Chair.
But I'm going to come out and bring the last bit of paper, right?